It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Theron and Richard Campbell are here. Yes, Richard has some nice Australian beverage, adult beverage, to share with you. Paul's got some Xbox tips. He's on to a new browser once again. And we'll talk about the FTC and the Microsoft-Activision merger for a little bit. Maybe even getting a tussle. It's all coming up next on Windows Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Theron and Richard Campbell, episode 868, recorded on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2024. Polly Browserus. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Collide. When you go through airport security, there's one line where TSA agents check your ID, and then there's another one where the machine scans your bag. Same thing happens, well, it's supposed to happen, enterprise security, instead of passengers and luggage, of course, it's end users and their devices. Unfortunately, these days, while most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation, you know, checking user identity, a lot of times user devices can just roll right through authentication without getting inspected. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in months. Or worse, that laptop could belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide solves this device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, your contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/WW to watch a demo and see how it works. That's KOLIDE.com/WW. It's time for Windows Weekly. Get ready, kids. Everything you want to know about the world's most valuable company right here with these two. Is it still the world's most valuable company?
Are we your most valuable company?
You're my MVP, most valuable podcasters. Paul Theron, Theron.com. Richard Campbell, runisradio.com. Rich is in focus. Paul's not. Don't comment on that. Also, for the person who emailed saying Leo's headphone pads are in horrible condition, I got two new headphone pads, which I will install during this program.
He says threateningly.
So do not fear. Your long nightmare is over. Ear pads. Paul, actually, John Slanina was chagrined by the email.
Chagrined?
Chagrined.
At what? At me?
No, at me. He takes his responsibilities seriously.
Oh, thank God.
And keeping me in non-tattered earmuffs is, according to him, one of his responsibilities.
Leo, I know we're trying to save money, but how about throw out the $2 for the earmuffs?
I think it's good. In fact, I'm going to start dressing in rags and tatters and beg, you know, take a page from Joel Osteen and really, really put it out there.
Well, rent a stadium is your church.
Okay. Yeah. Let's get off this subject and get on to the subject we've all come for: Windows 11.
So, on that note, as I was writing up the notes today, it occurred to me that everything on this show almost overlaps with each other. You know, in the sense that you could pick a topic and say, "Okay, is this a Windows topic? Is this an AI topic? Is it an antitrust topic?" Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of overlap. So this will be an interesting mishmash. As we go forward. So we'll see how it goes. I'm positive we're not talking about the most important thing right up front. So you got to stick around.
Oh, you're going to save the best for last.
It's going to build. It's going to build.
Ooh.
And if anything, the Xbox part of the show might be the biggest part of the show.
Ooh,
we'll see.
Even more exciting. Well, okay. Let's kick it off with 24H2.
H2, as we say here in the UK. So last week we talked about how there were more and more indications that the next big version of Windows would be called Windows 11 24H2.
Yeah.
This past week. And Microsoft likes to announce stuff right after we're done recording. In fact, I think they wait literally for us to get off the air to hit the, you know, publish button. And they made some big changes over in the Insider program. And in doing so, confirmed that the next major release of Windows will be 24H2. It will be this year's annual feature update is the way they said it, which, by the way, does not preclude there from being a Windows 12, I guess, or whatever, nor does it necessarily preclude there being a big update before then. We know there's a Moment 5 coming as soon as 2 weeks from now in preview form. We'll see what that looks like. But in making this announcement, they put the Canary and Dev channels on the same build stream, if you will, the 2600, 26,000 series.
Well, how dare they? And they?
Yeah. So temporarily, they're actually getting the same builds. So they haven't said how temporary that is. We had talked in the past about how Canary might be Windows 12. I mean, I guess this in a way confirms that in the sense that 24H2 is what we thought of as Windows 12. It just gets more and more confusing, but I think
we are at a place now where it's just version numbers are declared, right? They're constantly shipping features. Just when they
feel like,
make that a version.
I would put it like there's a roulette wheel and they spin it, and then whatever lands is what they announce ship whatever that day, right? Because there's no sense of precedent anymore, which I find troubling, as you guys know. So this new build that went out to the Canary and Dev channels includes one feature I think that everyone will be interested in, which is the sudo command from Linux for Windows.
We call that sudo.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I don't know why. No. It looks like sudo to me, but
yeah, I'm not gonna even try to say that. I can't even promise I could. Sudo?
Yeah,
like super user do.
User do.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
I know.
No.
So
I say sudo. Listen, does sudo make me a sandwich all day long?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I'll try to avoid saying it because I know it's just going to upset people. That wasn't my goal. But
listen, if you were going to try and avoid saying upsetting people, you'd not be making a podcast.
You know, that sudo that you do, it shimmies right through you, as Adam Ant would say. Anywho, yeah. So, yes, I think I'm surprised Windows hasn't had something like this, frankly. I know there are third-party tools. I think there's something called GSUdo.
Runas. Right? Mm-hmm. That was the same kind of thing. I need an elevated privilege, but it was literally an elevated privilege as an execution path as opposed to elevate my privilege.
Like a process, basically. Like bringing it from a session down to a process, essentially. Is how I sort of think of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's still... It depends on how it's configured, but normally it's like you are literally, for this statement, elevate my privilege.
Yes, right. Yeah, so for example, one thing I've been working on, and my God, struggling with this past week, has been documenting the changes I've made to my Winget-based bulk app install script, right? And there's all these options you can add to the Winget install command that do things like suppress warnings or suppress confirmation requirements or whatever it might be, right? And as I kind of went through the list of the things I had changed, and some things I still struggle with, I got to one where I don't remember which apps, but there were, I think, I want to say three or four of the apps that I install throw up a UAC prompt, right? User account control. And you know, no, right? The goal of this is to automate the process. Anytime you throw something up that I actually have to manually reply to, that's automation is done. Now, I don't have sudo yet, but I mean, I think I might use sudo eventually, I suppose. But but it'll still be a prompt, right? So my solution to this, and you'll love the word solution in this context, is to just run it in an elevated terminal window, right? In other words, just run the whole thing at elevation. Who cares?
I am administrator. Do my bidding.
Yep. And I'm going to close that window when I'm done anyway. So who cares? Right. So that kind of gets around that problem. But I do like the idea of running an individual command as an administrator and having everything else be in standard user space, right? I mean, that's the way we do things in Windows graphically, right? It's shocking to me, frankly, that we don't have this natively in Windows.
I mean, there's another side of sudo, which is also often that will then lead to an authentication prompt of some kind. Do we have an identity that is at system user level available to us? Like, we already have the token for that, so we swap to that token. If you don't, it's like, all right, you give me a password. That's a prompt. Like, you're broken again.
Yeah. Well, you know, Windows, we've struggled with this stuff for a long time, right? I mean, from going from 9X into the NT world, we, you know, had to adopt this sense of users. I was just thinking about this the other day, how strange it is in a way, right? That because of the way Windows has sort of evolved over time, we have a program files directory, and then of course an x86 version. But, you know, some apps install per user, some apps install for everybody. Sometimes an app will give you the choice, depending on the tool you're using.
Listen to the choice you gave it, you know.
Absolutely. That's actually where I was getting. So that's kind of a weird problem, right? WinGet install has an option, a dash dash something that I think it might be just scope, where you scope it to the user or to all users.
Right.
And to me, A, that it doesn't work. And B, it's not granular enough. And C, how is it that Windows today hasn't evolved past a global program folders? There should be one for everybody and then one inside of the user account for everybody. And they should all be visible and easily accessible and transparent. And when we install apps, those should always be the choices, right? That should just be the way the system is. But I think it's just a historical...
Granular security is hard. You either have no privileges or all privileges.
That is easy. But like you said, that still screws up too. And it's very interesting. Anyway, so Windows is I've said this many times, right? It's an archaeological dig of various strata, and you can kind of look at things and almost tell where it came from or when it came from.
Yes, the punishments of APIs gone by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry. That was a big digression for a sudo. I'm going to try that. I hate that term, but whatever.
By the way, that's just how they say you should say it.
Well, who's they? Right. Who's they?
Next, you're going to talk about JIF and JIFE, right? Like,
I'm not going to talk about that because the inventor of that was very clear on how that is pronounced, right? To me, what's the definitive source for sudo or sudo?
That's a good question. Probably Wikipedia. Let's go to Wikipedia.
Well, no, I mean, in other words, this isn't really from Linux.
Well,
there is a site, sudo.com.
By the way, this I should pull this up because I could give you the definitive answer from sudo.ws.
I love that you said it that way.
It says it right there, sudo. Okay. It even says it right here, sudo. But no one, you know, I mean, that's just...
We've had this discussion about how Alanis Morissette had that song Ironic. Of her examples were wrong because they were not ironic. But the words are... ephemeral. Their meanings change over time. And thanks in part to that song, actually, the literal definition of that term has changed because
as opposed to the figurative definition.
Yes. And maybe both, but the definition has changed. And I would argue that if enough people are saying sudo, I guess it would be sudo, like sudoku.
Sudo. Yeah, like sudo.
I would imagine most people
English
say
is,
that.
English is
and
a,
if that's the case,
a living it entity. Way, it's breathing, living should, breathing.
We should agree that that's the name. Or the pronunciation, I guess. I don't know.
I want to ask. Move on.
You know, I'm going to make literally and figuratively mean the same thing, then you could live with sudo.
Yes.
I guess the question is it offensive to someone who feels strongly about it to...
I'm sorry, you're talking about Linux users?
Look, somebody was offended by the muffs on my headphones. Yeah. By the way, Devin from Ottawa, he says, Leo's AKG headphones are gross and need replacing. They're really in bad shape. I can barely watch these days. I own a pair of K240s and love them. My third pair, in fact. Buy a new pair, Leo. They're not expensive. I will tell you, Devin, that because frugality is the message of the day here at
Thank
Twit,
you.
I, in fact, did not buy a new pair of $70 headphones, but instead replaced the earpieces so for your comfort and convenience.
By the way, these cheap little Sony things that I've been wearing for decades, which I can no longer, you have to buy on the, like the black market now. One thing that you can buy, because I was, they were so cheap, I would just replace them, but you can buy the little muffs, I guess, the ear pad.
Yeah, of course you can.
I have a bag of them here, and I have a bag of them back in, I almost said Boston, in the United States, wherever I live now. And because I use the same type, not the same exact set, but I don't move them back and forth. But yeah, they're easy to replace, right?
Easy to fix. And I just did. And now, Devin, you must join Club Twit for $7 a month because I've saved you 60 some dollars. By the way, ChatGPT says the pronunciation of pseudo can vary, but is commonly pronounced either sudo. Okay. Which I've never heard, sudo.
Which is, well, I think that's what I said. That's how I would say it.
Sudo, even though, or sudo. They don't mention sudo, but, and you know what? I think ChatGPT is the linguistic expert, so we're going to defer.
Okay.
And you can say sudo.
Yeah.
Which I've never heard.
Sudo comes out of my mind. No, sudo. I think I said sudo.
Yeah, I think sudo is probably. Yeah, let me see what Google says.
We're certainly going to beat this one to death.
You pronounce pseudo. Okay. I think I've looked this up before. This has come up many times. According to Linux.org, would that be a definitive enough site for you?
It would, yeah. Actually, yes, it would.
Well, yep. Like so many things, I learned it wrong early on, says Atanir, well-known member. But there's no hope for me to change in time, so I think I'm incorrectly saying sudo because sudo makes more sense when you remember the command. So maybe sudo is not even in the choices. Maybe it was just I was wrong. I was wrong.
So
here's from slash r sysadmin. R slash sysadmin. Sudo or sudo? I didn't know. So you what? You know what? You pronounce it any way you want.
Okay. Yeah.
Nobody's going to die.
Yeah.
I just I don't want to upset anybody, unless I do, of course. And in that case,
hey, at least I've got new earmuffs, and at least
it's true. The world, Devin, the world's a better place.
Devin is
okay,
now.
Let's happy. Now that we've spent 25 minutes on this. also, in this combined Canary dev channel build, end of support for Windows Mixed Reality. We knew that was coming.
Yep,
that's gone. The Copilot icon in the taskbar will change to a little pencil when you are copying text so that you you can visually see that maybe you could do something with that text with Copilot, I guess.
What? Why for Copilot? Why not just, that's kind of a cool idea to have an icon change because you're carrying around something in the clipboard, but only for Copilot? So click on Word, it goes away?
Right. Yeah. Why? Richard, listen, I don't even know how far I could destroy this podcast right now and spend 2 hours on this topic. But let me see if we can get through this.
All the time.
No, so easily.
Yes. Paul's icon rant.
Yeah. No, it's not about icons. It's about the kind of haphazard way things are implemented, right? Microsoft Copilot in Windows is everything you need to know about Windows today, right? And what I mean by that is that on the one hand, it's AI. They had to get it out there really quick. But on the other hand, it's also how they roll things out in Windows, right? They put it out there first, and then they start fixing it over time, right? So why isn't it a floating window? Why isn't it an alt tab? Why can't I put it on different sides of the screen? Why can't I? And the reason is they compiled it one time, and it worked, and they shipped it. And then people started complaining or providing feedback. And then they, you know, over time, they will update it. And so this is Windows 11 in a nutshell, right? The, what are we, 3 years in? And you could argue today we have that version maybe we should have had 3 years ago. Like, this is how things are done. So in Canary,
they make Windows different, and then they found out that nobody wanted that. So now it's Windows the same.
Yeah. There are Copilot changes coming both in pre-release and the stable version of Windows, which we'll get to in a moment. But yeah, they're just throwing stuff against the fan, basically, which is not the best way to see if it sticks. But this is the Microsoft way of doing things, right? So it doesn't make any sense. And so, yeah, Copilot's icon will turn into a pencil as a drop target so you can do something with text, right? Summarize it, explain it, just put it into the chat window and do more stuff with it, maybe make a picture, whatever. I don't know. So
I mean, why wait for us to paste as soon as you saw it was copied, start acting on it?
Again, you talk logic, you talk reason, you talk sense. I love it. I wish you were running Windows. You know, I really don't.
But, you know, yeah, on the inside of that company, things are so much more complicated. There's nothing like having to implement for 120 languages and 150 cultures.
Yeah, no, I hear you. But I would just say that I would add to that. I'm not disagreeing. I would just say, right. And maybe that is why these things require a little more testing, you know, before you put it out in the world. Now, we're talking about the Canary and Dev Channel, so they are testing it, right? I mean, but as well, we'll talk in a moment, some of the stuff's coming to stable too. A year ago, February, I wrote an article about how that I called This is Windows 12. And I wrote about all the stuff. At the time, Microsoft had just made their Bing announcement. ChatGPT 4 had come out the previous November. There was this, Satya Nadella was talking about AIing all the things, which is not the way he put it. But, you know, that's my my AI summary of that statement. And I kind of went back and looked at that and I thought, you know, it's really interesting. Like this stuff is all still happening, but it's still like happening. Right. And I think the big difference between last year and this year is the sheer number of things that Microsoft announced and started shipping in various forms, AI related, Copilot branded, et cetera. And then we got the MPUs finally in some semi form of volume on various chipsets across the platforms. We've got this new version of Windows, which is now, you know, 24H2, not Windows 12. And what does it mean to Windows? So what is AI going to do to Windows? What does that look like? And the interesting thing is, I keep talking about Stevie Patish and those three application structures, yeah, inside, outside, and the orchestrated one, the elsewhere, or whatever, however you want to call that. And I've talked about the examples he used and everything. But back in February, before he ever said it, I actually used the word orchestration, interestingly, to describe how Windows could change, and that today we run apps and in the future we may run prompts, essentially, where we basically describe, whether it's graphically or voice or text or whatever, what it is we want to do. And it is the system that determines which apps or services, right, need to step in at different phases of the way. Like,
it's going to lead to some lovely purse fights inside of Microsoft. Like,
oh yes,
what app gets put up forward first, right?
Yep. Yep.
But also that this was Gates's vision ages ago.
Yes, it was.
Idea, you know, the object-oriented operating system was about, you don't select an app, you work on a document, whatever, yep, that, whatever,
yes, tool needs. 100%. That's exactly right. And what's interesting to me, you nailed that. That's exactly true. Microsoft has tried to implement this in kind of, I don't mean to say in half-assed ways. That's unfair. I mean, given the technology of the day, they did what they could, but
The couple, Microsoft Bob,
but yes, Bob, and Bob. The ones people might really remember and really have used were the document centric interface in Windows 95, which is exactly what you just described, that Olay thing where you had an Excel thing inside of a Word document and the toolbars would change to the Excel toolbars, and yep, it was just too complicated for most people, right? And the other big one, I think, would be the kind of you at the center interfaces, most famously implemented as the hub structure in Windows Phone, where we apps go to the background. We don't worry about apps, but we say, I want to do a thing. I want to share a photo. I want to edit a photo. I want to, you know, I want to do something with a photo. And you would go into the pictures hub or the photos hub, whatever it was called. And you had connected your services to this backend, and right, you didn't have to worry about where things were. Well, and that was a great idea. The
whole idea that I have people, and you know, there was that ritual you had with Windows Phone where you'd sit down and say, these three identities, these are actually the same person.
Yes, you would connect. Right. That's exactly right. And mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually one of the lesser known, because it only lasted the one version, I believe, but the messages app, whatever that was called, as originally implemented, was SMS and MMS and Skype, and it was in Facebook Messenger, by the way, yeah, right at the beginning. And of course, Facebook was the first company that finally said, "You know what? This is
this doesn't benefit us.
No, we want people to think of Facebook. Of course, we do. So that was the wrench that kind of got in the way of that plan.
Beginning of the
this thing I just described with like the OS as an orchestration point, we'll run into some of the same debates and problems, right? There are going to be the apps inside Microsoft, especially Office, that are going to say, no. We're not an ingredient in a recipe.
This product cannot exist because it impacts other people's promotions.
Yes. So I would say Office has a big enough bubble of its own.
Yeah, no,
or Microsoft 365, I guess it's the right thing to call it.
No, you're right. This is why M365 will win.
Yeah, because they can do this. Yeah, but this is, in many ways is smarter is a tough word, but a more modern version of one of those if then this, then that type situations. Yeah. Or what do we have, like a Power Automate type thing in Windows today? Where Windows in this case, or Microsoft 365 or whatever it might be, is doing the heavy lifting, right? For this to work, the user can't do too much of the plugging and playing, right? It has to kind of occur at the system level.
No, and you would hope that if you look at it from an ecosystem perspective, that any application installed into Windows would plug into an interface that now gave you a way to communicate with
people. You would hope that, Richard.
I'm not saying I'm not deluded. Right?
Yes.
Because, of course, M365 has its own marketplace. And so there are going to be third-party tools that are going to be presented that way. That is a way more organized team than the Windows team. I think they're going to win this one. And then on top of that is the graph, which I think is actually the most important source of data.
I don't necessarily mean winning or losing. I just mean implement, like happening, right? I agree.
Yeah, they're going to build more in less time, and they're going to get better customer feedback, and they're going to run away with it because they're just going to get ahead of that curve.
Well, So this has been a big fight for a long time, right?
Yeah. In fact, they also have a monthly billing mechanism they can collect on. The Windows team doesn't. Like, they have all the pieces in place to out-innovate the rest.
The right solution here is for Windows to assume its rightful place as a component of Microsoft 365, which it technically is, and just make that part of the value you get.
Well, when an operating system becomes plumbing, the same way that microcode and the CPUs become plumbing, the same way that BIOS become plumbing, like the OS is on its way to being plumbing, where we don't want innovation, we just want reliability.
Again, 100%. I agree with you totally. I think that, Windows obviously has had things like, default apps for or default, this app will open this file type, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We have this notion of default browsers, right? Which is a slightly, it's not too much more complicated really, but it's a slightly more complicated thing. We're introducing protocols and
also one that was sort of forced on them by the industry. Like, there's another side to this, Paul, which is at what point does it become anti-competitive?
Right. Well, that one I can't answer. But I'm just more concerned right now with like what might they actually implement. Remember when Cortana came to the desktop? Mm-hmm. I said and probably wrote that I'd be surprised if Microsoft doesn't add a default personal assistant, like they have for web browsers. And I think only Amazon's assistant ever came to Windows, but in an open ecosystem like Windows, that's how it should work, right?
Yeah.
And that if you have Copilot orchestrating things for you, you might, as the user, be able to, or apps might do this as part of their install, say, look, these are the types of, it's not just like file types, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like tasks or activities. Like, these are the types of things that we want to register as being handlers for.
And arguably give preference to. When I want to edit a photo, I want to use this. When I want to, edit a video, I want to use this. That sort of prioritization. Because you always, just right click on that file type and see how many open widths you've got.
Right? Oh, geez. It's horrific going into that
interface. So now throw that chat interface over top of that.
So the advantage that Office has, I keep thinking of it as Office still, but these end user applications and services, whatever they might be, is that they actually do have enough capability that you could argue there is an end-to-end solution here for these things that I'm describing, right? That a Microsoft 365, I guess, there's enough there that you could do most of what we're talking about, right? And stay in that ecosystem, right? Mm-hmm. And there's an advantage to that, to Microsoft, but also to, corporate customers that want to just keep, just...
I'm not saying people aren't walking gleefully into the walled garden.
Sure.
Yeah. This was supposed to be the open place, right? But it's interesting to realize the open place would be Windows owns the Copilot and all these different third-party apps can come to the party. But I just can't imagine that happening with the state of Windows and the state of M365, which does have a massive customer base. And again, visibility into the graph, which is going to give you insight that nobody else has. So, yep. and its own marketplace and its own billing mechanism. Like there's so many.
I hear you. But Mozilla is going to come up again today. But last week we discussed this notion that Microsoft, especially, although I think Apple did this to some degree as well, contorted their desktop operating system, which to date has been the Wild West with regards to these types of things, an open platform, essentially not open code, but open, you know, to outside applications and services, mm-hmm. and has made it more mobile-like, more locked down, more like a walled garden. And I think those kind of forces are going to come into play here as well, right? This, you don't walk that back unless you are forced to, right, by laws and or regulations. So
I wonder if at some point we don't have a regulator clue into the fact that they're now going to create a set of interfaces that make you feel like you never need to choose an app. We'll take care of that for you. You know what apps are going to choose.
I know. Well, this is where the power of the defaults kicks in again. And
yeah.
Then
you brought up the whole browser thing. Like once upon a time, Microsoft tried to say, well, there's only IE. It's intrinsic to the operating system. You use Windows, you have to use IE. Yep. That didn't go well.
It did not work well. Yeah. It didn't go well.
So well, I'm just curious.
The other thing I just want to throw out with regards to what this year looks like with AI and Windows is, well, we did just get our first generation of MPU-based computers. Not really, but I mean, it's shipping in volume, I guess. How does that change anything in Windows? To this day, we still only have one feature in the entire operating system that requires an MPU, but we have a dozen or more that we might point to and say, hey, this is AI.
I would argue that Android's doing a better job of utilizing their internal hardware than Windows is so far.
Yes, I agree with that, actually. Yeah. Well, yeah, because Windows isn't doing anything. Yeah, you're right. You are 100% right.
And, again, there was a Windows that would have been there would have been a WinHack by now where all the vendors would be lined up and say, these are the interfaces you use. Here's how you get the advantage of it. You know, get to it.
Well, there's a worry there that the industry has its kind of hopes set on MPU and these new ultra core, you know, processors kind of jumpstarting PC sales again. And we know that PC sales have in fact gone back up a little bit, but low bar there. And that happened before we had these things. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if this is going to trigger. We're still in a wait and see situation there. So I'm just
totally, but you know, show me the killer app, Paul. For the average consumer. This is still a toy. Devs are in, right? There's a non-trivial number of developers I'm talking to today. It's like, if I didn't have GitHub Copilot, like I'm not going to make my deadlines. Like that's now becoming a requirement in their productivity. I don't see that in other areas of expertise yet.
Yeah. But,
you know, that's the group you're looking for.
There's a good set of advice you could offer people about the types of things that are good to do, useful to do, however you want to say it, with AI. Things that are not so good, right? We just tried to get AI to tell us how to pronounce sudo or whatever it is.
It sure ended up being Wikipedia that won that one in the end, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The new king looks just like the old king there. But none of this benefits Windows because all of those things run in the cloud and don't require Windows. In fact, most of those things will probably always run better in the cloud because they rely on this infinite data pool we have on the back end anyway. So, yeah.
And giant language models that don't fit into your machine.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's my little bit of cause speculation.
All good news.
Yeah. At least we know how to pronounce sudo now. Anyway.
Yes. So we got that out of it. We got that going for us.
You're watching Windows Weekly, listening to Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, Richard Campbell. It's a little rainy here in Petaluma today, but I'm sure it's beautiful where you guys are. Richard's in Sydney, Australia. Are you there for family or a conference?
Conference.
Nice. Yeah.
Doing my From Mono to Maui talk today.
I love it. It sounds like travel, but it's not. And then there's Paul Thurrott, who's enjoying a nice Mexican hot chocolate in beautiful Mexico City. Oh,
that's a Mexican iced water.
Oh.
But, yeah. Filter.
You're going to be in Acapulco when, Richard?
I'm doing Puerto Vallarta in 10 days.
We're going to be in Cabo
in a month. So we'll miss you.
Well, yeah. We're all going to just...
Different sides of the country.
Yeah.
I just find it amusing there might be a point where we're all in Mexico, but not together.
That would be funny. And it's probably close. How long are you going to be in PV?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Oh, we'll just miss you. March 11th. Yeah. We're getting there.
We should figure something out. When are you going?
March 11th through 23rd. Richard's going in 2 weeks, you said?
Yeah, I'm
so you'll be there. You will just overlap, Richard, actually.
I'll leave on the 12th.
On the 12th. So on the 11th, let's all get together.
In the airport. Are you all flying through Mexico City?
I got directs. I get directs out of PV to Vancouver, which is very cool.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah.
Oh, right. PV. I'm sorry. For some reason, I had Cabo in my brain. Right. So PV is on the East Coast. Acapulco is far down.
Everything's on the West Coast. PV's on the West Coast.
Oh.
As is Cabo.
Cabo's into the Baja.
You're thinking Cancun, which is on Yucatan Peninsula. Cabo San Lucas, Puerto Vallarta, both on the West Coast. On the Baja.
So is Acapulco.
Is Acapulco. Yeah. We're on the Baja Peninsula.
Yeah. Beautiful spot.
Yeah. Beautiful. I can't wait. That's a Monday. The Wednesday following, you will be doing Windows Weekly from your respective homes. But we will have, I think, Michael Sargent filling in. So,
Okay. No, I think that's MVP Summit. So I'll probably be doing the show from Redmond.
Wow. You really must rack up the miles. Do you try to get it all on the same airline?
Well, I'm not that idealistic, but I fly enough that I can generally carry top tier status on two airlines in a year.
Nice.
But you sort of mix it up, whatever makes it fun. You don't really have a choice of airlines. Like, it's all an illusion.
Yeah, that's the sad thing. And I think that's why these loyalty programs don't make a huge amount of sense.
No. Well, plus they've also come up with their own currency.
Hold on a second. Right.
It used to be mileage.
But to me, like Paul, who's always flying to the same place, Mexico.
Yeah, it benefits us greatly, actually.
So yesterday, did we do the Patch Tuesday?
Nope.
That was yesterday.
Yep.
Anything you want to say about that? We continue on with this weekly. Yes.
So Microsoft did test putting Copilot on... in a different location on the taskbar. They want to move it to the right of everything else, basically over past the clock and the little notification bell.
That's where mine is. Yeah.
It is?
Yeah. Really?
Are you in the Insider program?
I don't know where I am. See, that's what you're talking about is over here, this thing. It's in where the charms used to be.
I'm on a laptop, so I can't see everything at once.
It's where the charms were. Yeah.
So it's starting with the Patch Tuesday update for Windows 11. 23H2, they are going to start rolling that out. It will start moving for people in 22H2, I guess. I'm not seeing it yet on any of my computers. I have updated with the Patch Tuesday update, but it's one of those slow boil things. So that is happening, I guess. I don't know what to say about that, but...
It seems creepy. This icon is sort of moving around.
And I'm thinking, what do I have on here? Insider. I'm on the Windows 11 Pro Insider Preview 22H2. Weird. 22H2. Wait a minute. Shouldn't I be on 24H2?
No.
That's very confusing.
23H2 is the current version.
I'm on 22H2, it says here. Installed on February 2nd. This is very confusing.
Okay.
All right.
I don't know.
Never mind. Who cares about? You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
I can't. Listen, Leo, a couple of years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I could have told you exactly what was wrong, exactly how to fix it.
Now you don't care.
No, it's not that I don't care. It's impossible. It's not me.
Unknowable.
I'm not joking. It's just impossible.
I need a restart. That's why. Let me restart. This will shut the entire podcast down.
Go well. Anyway, it's
fade to black.
Everything's different. So, and it, like I said, there's no sense of precedent. It doesn't matter how things used to be. It doesn't matter how things were last month. It could be any way tomorrow. I am not going to pretend that I'm used to it or okay with it. I'm just trying to come to terms with it. It's just the way things are. So,
our lives are now a non-deterministic cloud of frustration.
Yeah.
But at least my files are exactly where I left them.
Sure they are.
Are they? They might not be, because that's another thing to screw with is OneDrive. And they'll move those around too.
Oh, no.
Brave shipped the stable version of their browser in on ARM. It's been like, I thought this has been around for a while, but they just announced it. So I guess it's now in stable. You may recall a couple of weeks ago, Google announced that Chrome was available in Canary. So that will be coming to ARM soon in stable, 6 weeks, whatever that time frame is. So that's happening. So it's there now for Brave. If you want that feature complete, et cetera, everything in Brave on x86 is available on ARM. So that's cool. All hey. Native code.
Are you still using Brave or did you move to Edge?
Yep.
I mean, ARM.
No, moved to Edge. Yeah.
No, sorry. That was a slip.
Yeah. ARM. No, I have been on this trip, especially kind of multi-browser, because I'm testing it. I'm running some stuff on security and
polybrowserous. Yeah.
Polybrowserous. Yeah. I'm browser curious. the truth is I've always been like that when it comes to, I mean, honestly, most applications, but browsers, especially browsers, are so important. So I've been writing this series of security articles and I'm trying to do things in different ways on different browsers and see how things work, you know, just whatever. So lately it's been a lot of Chrome, which is something I don't usually use, Edge, which I hate to use, but I'm updating that part of the book. I'm using Firefox, Arc.
I'm really loving Arc, but on Mac. Arc, you know, I don't have the invite for Windows. So
the version on Windows isn't there yet. For a variety of reasons. But one of the things you lose are your, what do they call the sidebars?
The boosts?
You create like a custom.
The Macs, the boosts. They got names for everything.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Spaces. Yeah.
Spaces, thank you.
I like those.
I'm not going to recreate the space every time. One of my issues, one of the things because of what I do is I bring up computers all the time, reinstall, you know, and if it can't sync, I'm not going to recreate manually right on every computer every time. It just doesn't make sense. So
I can sync.
They'll get it there.
Yeah. I love it.
And we'll talk about that in a moment too.
Okay.
And then there are indications that Microsoft might be adding an AI upscaling feature for games. And we've talked about this in the context of things like NVIDIA has a tool set where you can bring forward an SD game to the modern world and it upscales and you can do 4K and HDR and, you know, stuff like that is awesome. Having the operating system just do this automatically for older games would be cool as well. And this is a rumor for now, but someone has found, or a little better than a rumor, someone has shown screenshots of this interface in the settings app on 24H2 and what this could look like. So, yeah, that sounds like a neat idea for me. So,
it's kind of an argument. We have so much horsepower, we're just going to brute force upscale an app,
you know,
against its will.
That's amazing. Yeah, I like actually.
It. Bring it to its knees. Why not?
Yeah,
I think this is entirely in keeping with the whole Windows philosophy in some ways, right? That in the old days, we always brought forth DOS games, right? We had in XP, as things switch over to the NT world, this notion of program compatibility modes and, you know, running things, you know, with special settings to make it seem like an older version of the operating system. Like this is in our wheelhouse, you know, it's good. Okay. Moving forward again, I didn't know what to call this section. Honestly, it's a grab bag of stuff that are not always entirely related, but AI, antitrust, I could have put this in with cloud server. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on this week. There was a report on, I think it was CNBC, quoting two analysts. So, you know, asterisk, but based on various indication they're getting from their own sources that Azure, which has historically been about half the size of AWS by revenue, they believe is now two-thirds or more and is growing. Well, we know it is growing much faster than AWS right now and could actually surpass AWS by revenue within a couple of years, all thanks to AI, right? Whatever the real numbers are, I mean, the bit that we know from public statements and financial reports and so forth is that Azure is part of Intelligent Cloud. We know the growth rate for Azure, but we don't know. We've never gotten a baseline revenue number, so we can't actually say with any certainty how much money it makes. Profitability is another thing, but whatever. Amazon has always been very explicit about AWS, which I think is cool and the right way to do things. But you can kind of compare these businesses, and you can look at the business overall, and you can look at growth numbers. And it's fair to say that, and I pointed this out with Microsoft's revenues, Intelligent Cloud and Azure growth were both greater than revenue growth at AWS, like much
more. One would argue that we'll know when Azure's supersedes AWS when AWS starts concealing their numbers, because that is the US.
Oh, market. Okay. I was going to use the opposite extreme, which is, I think, equally true when Microsoft says it did. Yeah. You know, like, in other words, one day we will get, the way it starts is they'll say something like, Azure is on an annual run rate to exceed yada, yada, yada in revenues. And that number will be bigger than what AWS has been.
Right. AWS will come up with a term like the amazing cloud, which represents an array of products.
That's right.
And you don't know what the revenues are for any of them.
You've heard the term moving the goalposts, right? When you're not winning the game, you move the goalposts. Microsoft has dismantled the goalpost and hidden parts of it all over the field. It's a completely different thing.
Oh, and in the effort of disclosure, they keep saying things like, is that a goalpost over there?
Yeah, yeah. And everyone's like, looks, and then, you know, like a rabbit comes out of his sleeve. Microsoft has...
Even then, it's a reasonable question to say, when you say Azure, do you mean M365 as well? Because it does also run cloud, right?
Right. These things are purposely commingled and confused, and it's hard to say, right? But I Microsoft, in this case, has this combined cloud business that is not the Microsoft cloud that they talk about, right? Because those are cherry-picked numbers. But if you look at their cloud-based businesses overall, if you could somehow add up the revenues and all that stuff, obviously it's humongous. We don't have to put a big number on it. The question is, what percentage of, you know, Microsoft's revenues literally come from the cloud? Mm-hmm. And it's got to be north of 50%. It's got to be.
Easily. Yeah,
I would say that. Got to be.
Yeah, I'd be very, you know, and again, it's like you're using revenue numbers versus customer counts or seat counts. Like, yeah. I'm very interested in the idea of what's left still in the volume license agreement and what does that represent? You know, that hasn't been modernized to a monthly bill.
So we talked about this a little bit. I think it was last week or the week before, this notion that Microsoft was asked a question during the post-earnings conference call. So it must have been last week. And this person said, I don't understand how this grows. Like, haven't you kind of saturated this market? This was seats for Office or Microsoft 365 commercial. And honestly, for all the lack of transparency we get out of Microsoft, they were pretty good about this one. They said, you know, yeah, we actually had plateaued. We started introducing these lower end frontline SKUs, and we saw a couple of years of growth there. That's starting to taper off, but now we view AI, the Copilot stuff, as essentially a third tier. And so, if you think about, or not a third tier, I'm sorry, like another expansion of revenue on top of that. So, their argument was like, look, our seats aren't going to go up that much anymore, but our revenue per seat is going to go up dramatically.
Always better to sell more stuff to your existing customers.
Yeah.
It's a very efficient way to increase revenue.
Wall Street can be somewhat unsophisticated when it comes to certain things, right? So when Azure growth fell below 70, it was 70% consistent for a long time. And it started 60, 55, whatever the numbers were, people started freaking out. It's like, guys, this is mature. You know, it's much bigger now than it was. It doesn't matter if it's not growing as much. This is what we would expect, right? Yeah. And I think you can make the case for, you know, commercial seats, Microsoft 365. It's like, look, we've reached everyone we want to reach. We could introduce a $199 a month SKU, but we would just lose money on that. So who cares? Yeah. We're not going to do that. You know, it makes more sense for us to make more money per seat. And so I think by explaining that explicitly, it was almost like a little school session, like putting a little ad, sit in the seat. Listen, pay attention, you know, and with the hope of forestalling the inevitable complaints and possible stock price declines that occur when seat growth goes down, right? Goes down.
Yeah. I mean, recognize, of course, that valuations are insane, right? I get a sense from some folks at Microsoft, it's like they're freaked out by the $3 trillion too.
Yeah. So I never brought this up again. I should have. When Microsoft first surpassed $3 trillion in market cap, I noted that Apple had done it a few years earlier, but specifically mentioned that they didn't finish the day over three. Mm-hmm. It was 8 months later, I believe, that they were over three and stayed over three. Microsoft actually did it within the week. Like that's how different the world is. It's not that Microsoft is a better company or, you know, whatever. It's just that literally the excitement over AI is so great and the promise is so there or believed to be there that their market cap, I guarantee, well, I can't guarantee, but if you look at it today, I bet it's 3 point something. Yeah, it's working.
Well, the other conversation I had in this context was also, and baby boomers are retiring. And many of them have not built good portfolios. By golly, they're going to be keen on these top companies to keep performing at irrational rates.
Especially the company. I mean, and these are the companies these guys grew up with and know, and they're still around. And is Oldsmobile something I could still invest in? Is that a thing?
Look, I'm a baby boomer. We're not that nutty, okay? I mean,
are you sure?
Oh, Leo, are you back? I'm sorry.
Oldsmobile. Yeah, it's true. It's true. Actually, you know,
and besides, it
looks good in your portfolio to have all that going up and up and up. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I have friends who were working at Microsoft in the Ballmer years when it was $32 a share and they got their MAU
and it was time. You could hear the flatline beep for 10 years straight. Beep.
Yeah. You know who's breathing down their neck now, though, is NVIDIA. That's that proves what you're saying, Richard, that it's about AI.
Oh, my God. Of course. Their market cap, was it market cap, surpassed that of Amazon?
They're like number three now.
Back to irrational.
Yeah. That to me seems irrational, but I don't want to get off on
it. Well, we make fun of Google for being a one-trick pony. Then you look at NVIDIA and go,
because it's not just AI. They've got chips in cars. They put chips in gaming machines, crypto for a while.
Single percentage points compared to what
is AI the whole thing? Yeah. They just released, I'm actually wishing I had a Windows machine running an RTX 30 or 40 series because they just released their own chat GPT. Yeah, local.
That's
local.
Right.
And it's purely local. It'll read all your documents. Mm-hmm. It's based on Llama and I can't remember. It's two open source.
Does it literally drive up to your PC in a wooden rabbit? Or horse, rather? Like a rabbit. I think wooden rabbit was from
like
the
Like a Trojan
Monty
horse?
Python,
is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
Life of
like,
Brian,
we're
talking.
What's the packaging here?
Open up your PC.
And Studio 2 has both the MPU and a 4060.
Yeah.
So I should definitely install
it. I'd be so tempted.
Fight over.
Yeah. I love the idea of a local GPT. I think that's the future of GPTs is local.
Well, yes and no, right? But it depends, right?
Well, companies might push it because they...
local. I would call that local. Like
private.
This is,
and, yeah.
Right, that's right. Like a private cloud GPT kind of a thing. Yeah.
And it's just for me. I would like to have it so I don't have to worry if I'm online or not. I could just, you know.
Yep. Yeah. That will definitely be a thing.
And I
definitely
customize.
I have a focus on that for the house because I put the chat interface on the house now.
Exactly.
And the whole point is to be able to unplug the internet connection and it still works.
I mean, imagine like you feed into it all the manuals for all the devices in your house so you can query.
I love how full circle we've come, by the way. You know, it's like saying, I feel like the future of my music collection is going to be like some kind of a physical disc. and it's going to be really hard to do playlists because I'm going to like one song on this disc and one song on this disc.
Well, actually, honestly, want a hybrid. In respect to that, you probably do want a hybrid. Because you want local, so you can keep it local. No, but you also want it to surf the net and get late updated information.
Well, right. But but from a smart home implementation standpoint, like the argument is like for certain things, I want this just to be, this should work if the internet is down. It should work on this local set of whatever. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
But maybe even be better.
Not to make fun of your whole media statement, but when you count on a cloud provider to provide you with your music and they fail to renew a contract, you're like, hey, remember that music? You don't have it anymore.
Those incidents are what triggers this misplaced nostalgia for physical media, but maybe correct nostalgia for actually owning something.
Yeah, for the concept of ownership, not a in perpetuity license that isn't actually in perpetuity.
You're right. I see both sides of this. I just think, you know, when you think about how much money you might spend on music in a year and you look at the cost of a subscription and the access you get to the, what's the number now? 70 million songs or whatever. You know,
that's the one I'm looking for.
Right. Well, that's welcome to cable TV. You know, that's.
Yeah, well, isn't that coming back around too? Is bit by bit, we're getting consolidation this market.
Yeah, we are. YouTube TV is huge now, and it's basically cable. Over the top.
It will recreate.
Well, with one advantage. You can today say, nope, and tomorrow say yes.
That's true.
That's the advantage of the online service part of it. Yeah. It's huge. Yeah. It's huge. Anyway, this is, I don't know what this has to do with what we're talking about. Yeah, anyway, so.
Thanks for playing.
The EU came down today, I guess, this morning, and said that Microsoft Bing, Edge, and Microsoft Advertising are so small, they do not need to be regulated by the DMA.
We're number 10.
Yeah. I've never seen big tech companies celebrate their smallness so loudly as when they don't need to be regulated because not enough people use them. That's so funny.
As nobody cares.
Yeah, it's funny. iMessage also fell into this. They're huge in the United States, obviously, and probably in other parts of the world. Not so huge in Europe. So they're not. That's not going to be regulated there either. And that might be the more problematic of those. But
this also comes into a crazy level of granularity, right? It's like, well, what else? What else do we regulate because it's small for the moment? How do you measure small?
Yeah. Well, they have their metrics. Okay. So no surprise there. Google Gemini replaced Bard. We knew that was coming. I think
just a name, right?
It's just a name.
Just the brand. Yeah. The brand. The high-end Ultra LLM is available now, apparently. Grammarly is laying people off. Mozilla is laying people off. Mozilla has been kind of a not-so-slow-moving car crash lately, unfortunately.
That's so sad.
Yeah, we talked about this last week, but since then, Mitchell Baker stepped down as CEO for the second time. She's going back
Wait until we finish recording. Did you make that announcement?
Yeah. Executive chairperson, they hired this new CEO, former board member, and they've sent out a company-wide memo. I think TechCrunch got a part of it. They might be shutting down most of their consumer products that are not Firefox, including the one I recommended last week, which was that monitoring service.
Yeah, which they announced a week ago.
And yes.
That's, boy, that's beating Google to the punch even. Wow. Yeah.
Between last week's show and this announcement, I wrote an editorial probably over the weekend about web browsers and AI and talked about Arc and how, you know, it sometimes takes a company on the outside to kind of innovate and push things forward, like the iPhone was like that, right? You know, you almost have to lose to look at things differently. But it is shocking to me, no matter which browser you like or prefer or whatever, like how similar they all are. It's weird to me that Firefox or Mozilla has never really innovated in this space. In a meaningful way with the user experience, right? It's if you could time travel from 1996 to today and look at the web browsers, you say, they're prettier, but they, you know, I mean, I think Opera
icons are a bit flatter, but
yeah.
But the same thing happened to the phone before the iPhone. You know, phones were kind of weird. Like you'd get a slide out keyboard or a connector, this, a pop out that. Now they're all slapped with black glass.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there's always advantages and disadvantages, but I think the compelling thing about Arc and the reason we keep bringing up that browser is that, and I'm not 100% sure I like these guys or I'm having a hard time getting a feel for them as a company or people, but they really are going in innovative way. I think with the browser, looking at it differently, and it, you know what, it needs it. The web browser is the most important app that we all use. It, for many of us, is kind of the only app, really. I mean, and if it wasn't for the anti-competitive business practices of the two mobile providers, that would be true on mobile too, you know? So it's interesting. I think
what's unusual here, because it doesn't happen very often anymore, is Arc just presented you something you never knew you wanted.
Yeah, which is very right, which was the iPhone too, right? In some ways. Yeah. I mean, no one was saying, why don't we have this device?
Yeah.
That's right. There you go. I was in writing this, I was sort of talking about smaller things you could do. Like I really like the browser Brave, right? And I like it because it's private and secure by default.
It's not like it's an innovative browser.
That's what I mean. Is that the company's
mindset behind it?
Yeah. Is that like a form of innovation? And ultimately, I have to kind of say no, because two reasons. One, it hasn't changed the world, right? The whole world hasn't lined up again behind them to do the same thing. And, you know, I mean, not to be a jerk about it, but you could take Chrome even and install the right extensions and basically get, you know, to where you want to be, privacy and security wise. So, you know, I don't know. Right?
Brave just has a better set of defaults running against the same.
Yeah. Chromium. Yeah. There are other things going on there. It's also has to do with the lightweight nature of that. And, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it, but at a high level, I mean, you could kind of do a Brave with other products, and I don't know, you know, maybe that's not innovation. It doesn't mean it's not valuable. It's not, it doesn't mean I don't like it. It doesn't mean one might not like that thing. It's just, but web browsers are so important. I mean, I'm reading that Stephen Sanofsky book. He brings this up. This is something that's come up again and again, you know, that point in time where web browsers and web technology and web development surpassed everything else combined, basically. Yeah.
No, and you know, we could say about Sanofsky, but he called the ball on JavaScript being lingua franca, and we should focus on that.
That's right. That's a big, I mean, that's
how
big
we went about it. We can debate separately, but it wasn't wrong in that basic idea.
Yeah.
Hey, I got to call out what Zach was saying in the Discord, and let me pivot on a little bit, Zach, which is like, who buys Mozilla?
Right.
When it's this frail, and you know that concern, it, you know, same way that you sort of save, you know, we picked up the pieces of some microsystems or that sort of thing. One of these sort of legacy of the .com boom companies is on its knees. Somebody should scoop it up.
Yahoo should buy it.
Here's an idea. Why doesn't Mozilla buy Arc?
Yeah, like they had any money? Yeah. But,
well, they have some money. How big is this company?
They have that sweet Google money. They could, yeah. I think Arc, at this point, I'm starting to think Arc is designed to be acquired, right? I mean, there's no business.
I just want it to be acquired by someone that's going to continue forward with it, not kill it like Google, Apple, Microsoft would do, right?
Right. Well, and the real question is, and there's no money in browsers, right? Nobody's paying for a browser. Yeah.
Right.
So well, but that, so the money that, that's is in interesting. The Google backsheesh that they pay you to keep it as the search engine, make it the default search engine.
And that's how it's a great thing about browsers. We make it innovative browser so we can make you into the product.
Right. There may be a business model here that's just not obvious to us because we're so used to the status quo. You know, nobody buys Windows either, but we use it every day.
It does have direct revenue. Right.
Okay.
Well, I think Mashed Potato on our Discord has a point. People are Arc and Firefox may just be waiting until Google finally takes this final step into Manifest V3, and it's really kind of it's anti third party cookie stance, and it's anti extensions stance. And I wonder, maybe not. Most people aren't. That
I don't.
Savvy.
Think, I don't. I don't. Don't care. I think that's.
They're just going to keep using it. Chrome is just going to be the default. Yeah. Yeah,
I don't think the impact of that is going to be as great as people think. And I already we've heard from browser makers and extension makers that they're not going to implement it in the case of browsers, and or in the case of extension makers, it's like actually we're going to be able to work with this. But we'll see. We're going to find out.
Yep.
So yeah, you know, Mozilla. I just installed Firefox again last night. Actually,
it looks.
The browser.
It looks ancient compared to Arc, though.
Compared to Arc, everything looks ancient. Right. I would say in Windows, honestly, not counting Arc, it has the most modern UI that looks the most correct with the Windows 11 kind of look and feel, if that makes sense. I feel bad for. I really want. I really.
I know.
I would like this company to thrive. I feel bad for this.
Insanely guilty running Arc. Because I have to run Mozilla on my...
Don't be... No. You got to... Look, ultimately, we have to do the best thing for ourselves. And ultimately, the job of any company or organization is to serve its customers. And I don't... Firefox has definitely been hobbled by predacious big tech business practices. No doubt about it. But they've also made mistakes. And I think they're innovating in the wrong places. I think they walked away from PWAs for frick's sake. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that was
a mistake. They've just made some stupid mistakes. I like a lot of the stuff they do that's not Firefox. I use Pocket daily. I think these other things they do, email relay, the VPN, the monitoring stuff, to me, this all makes sense. They're allowing companies like DuckDuckGo, mostly DuckDuckGo, to kind of eat their lunch, basically, right? I mean, products like Brave, DuckDuckGo, Arc shouldn't exist. If Firefox had done the right thing, none of this could have happened. And that's sad. It's a sad.
Well, and it may be, maybe Baker's being pushed out because he doesn't have a good enough AI strategy. Like, I don't know how you're a tech company at this moment and survive any board without three slides on how we're all AI all the time.
Yep. So, Mitchell Baker, allegedly a big part of her new old job, will be focusing on AI to some degree. The new person running Mozilla, I apologize, I can't remember her name. She's a woman as well. Just kind of doubling down on Firefox. It's like kind of doubling down on Berlin at the end of the war, I guess. I don't, you know, like, what else are you going to do? Like, I, you know, yeah, okay. Well,
and especially since very likely there was a board meeting where the board said, what's your AI strategy? And he said, this is stupid. And they're like, we'll work somewhere else. Yeah,
exactly. The music from Benny Hill chimed in and we're like, all right.
And the first person says, I have an AI strategy. That's your CEO.
Yeah. This will not help Windows users yet, but Arc just delivered a native Arc Sync on the Mac, opening the door to it coming to Windows, because the old sync thing worked only through iCloud, right? So this is them actually trying to be cross-platform. Interesting. Yeah, so I'd love to experience that. I don't have my Mac with me here. I don't use it anyway. Who cares? Anyway, we'll get there. I'm I say this about a lot of things, actually. So DuckDuckGo, we're going to talk about that later in the show. Couple things missing. I could see doing that. Arc, obviously, I could see. So, but it needs a couple of the basics it just doesn't have. So we'll get there. I think it was during the earnings announcement, Sundar Pichai said that Google One would soon surpass 100 million paying customers. This is it started as their cloud storage subscription service for consumers. Now it's expanded to include a bunch of additional services, extra features and things like photos.
So you expand your customer base by increasing the number of products you consider part of the suite.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good offering, honestly. I mean, I pay for this. It's basically double the storage you get with Microsoft 365 consumer. So, you know, it's kind of it's not a bad service.
I have one as well.
Yeah. So they did hit that. But the big news there, the reason I'm mentioning this is because, you know, who cares about Google One really, except that they're adding a tier that is going to be their equivalent of Copilot Pro, right? So they're going to have an AI tier. I think it's, what is it called? AI premium plan. I was like, is it premium or AI? It's both. They're going to add AI capabilities to all of the core docs, sheets, slides, whatever apps, right? So that actually, in many ways, it's more equivalent to Microsoft 365 Copilot because it's kind of in the middle. It's an additional... No, it's the same. I'm sorry. Copilot Pro is an additional $20 per month, and that's what this is going to be as well. So yeah, kind of a consumer offering. But so the premium tier, which is the one I have, is 2 terabytes, $20 more a month to get the AI stuff. I'll look at that when that stuff's available. I don't see any huge reason to go there right now. I guess I assume you get the Gemini stuff and the web and all that or whatever, but I don't know. I'm going to wait. I'll wait for a little while. I've been pretty happy with my Copilot generated imagery so far. That's been nice.
Did you see the Copilot generated imagery ad on the Super Bowl?
No, so
it went by very quickly.
I watched the Super Bowl from Mexico.
Didn't see anything.
Two points to this. We were in a bar with friends. It was packed. It was like the NFL TV broadcast. So I think it was the CBS guys talking, like it was English, but the ads were Mexican ads. So they clearly have not gotten the message that these things are supposed to cost like $7 billion a second, because there was an ad for a mattress company that was local to Mexico
That's
City.
The local one, yeah.
There was like, yeah, it was really ridiculous. The ads were, it was horrible. So we watched some of the ads later. But the other thing was, most of the people, I would say, let's say 2/3 of the people there were Mexican, right? And the other third were Americans who were there specifically to watch the game, obviously, outside of the country. You know, Mexicans are fans of what they call football, or what we call soccer. And soccer fans and football, American football fans, are very different, right? We don't get a lot, we don't have a lot in the way of chanting in the United States, right? So most Americans can't even handle a wave. But these guys, it was funny to watch they were mostly chanting for San Francisco, which I found,
good.
I think it was easier to rhyme, but they would cheer for anything good that happened. They couldn't have cared less. Like, you could tell they were not actual football fans,
right?
But they were chanting like soccer fans. So
touchdown!
They would be like, No, and they would be like, San Francisco, 49ers. And I was like, what is happening? Like, it was like, it was so out of place. Like, it felt so wrong, you know, growing up on American football.
Paul. Come home to America. Let me play. This is, I mean, you could want to see it. Yeah, because this
will
tell you something about what Microsoft's planning. This was their Super Bowl.
Well, I did later watch ads, so I might have seen it.
Maybe it
I
didn't goes by so quickly. I saw it and I didn't realize what I was
seeing. Okay.
They say I will never open my own business, or get my degree, or wear a shark backpack. But they say I will never make my movie. Build something. Whoa. I probably shouldn't play the music, but I'm not to. They say I'm too old to learn something new, too young to change the world. Mm-hmm. But I say,
watch me. Just watch
me. And then it's Copilot. It's going to make that all possible.
But did human beings make that ad, or did AI
human beings made this ad?
Well, then who cares?
Quiz me in organic chemistry.
Oh, this, we talked about this. I had completely forgotten this was happening. Yeah, you're right. I don't think I did see that ad.
This is the long version. I don't think this is what I saw. This is the minute version.
Okay.
Which is $14 million.
Like a quickie.
Yeah, the one I saw was much quicker than that. So that's the...
Yeah, it's cheaper. You put the full version on YouTube.
Yeah, that's what they do. Yeah.
Who drove that ad instead of Microsoft? Is that Takeshi, the new Capsella?
The new marketing guy,
It's a great question. It's just like, who blew the $7 million bucks?
Yeah. Well, that... Yeah.
Look, they are going for it, you know? Whatever one thinks of the branding and the too many services and how fast they're moving and whatever, it's not just talk.
Yeah.
You know, I give them a little credit for this. I don't agree with it all, but
for a long time since Microsoft bought a Super Bowl ad, I think it's probably the...
Yeah, it's been 4 years. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Wow. Right. So, I mean, there's an ad on football every game. I think the only reason the Surface line continues is because you see it every Sunday on TV.
You know, right? Wasn't advertised. You know, who didn't advertise was Apple. They didn't show the Vision Pro. I mean, they sponsored the whole halftime, but that was more an Apple Music ad than anything else.
Yep. Well, that's probably a good enough exposure for them. I just got a brand out
just
there.
Just the name Apple. Used to be Pepsi. Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to distract. Keep going. Mm-hmm. You're watching Windows Weekly, Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell. Arm. It's an arm and a leg.
Right. So originally I thought, well, I'll have another earnings section here. It's the only company I had. So two notable things about this company compared to big tech, let's say, or technology, the earnings I typically write about. Numbers, pretty damn small, right? This is a net income quarterly, net income of $87 million on revenues of $824 million in a quarter. By the way, a record growth, record results, but also only the second of the results ever, because they just, you know, they're not really spun off. They're still mostly owned by whatever that Japanese company is, but them being public or whatever is a new thing. So conceivably, they could set a record every quarter if they wanted to. But we talk a lot about margins and how, you know, software historically much higher margins than hardware, Apple being the bizarre exception to that.
Yeah.
You will never see margins like this company. This company's margins in the quarter, 96%.
Oh my God.
this is what I imagine. There's a guy renting a space over a garage somewhere in England. He's sitting at a desk with like a blueprint type paper, and he's designing chips, and that's their overhead.
Listen, the whole thing, you thought the margins on software are good. You see the margins on licensing.
Yeah. Wow. Well, so that's actually the other thing. And their earnings report was so dense and big for what they do. It didn't make sense to me. They provided a lot more information than some of the biggest companies on earth. So much so that I had a hard time just getting through it. They make money two different ways. And I have to be honest, I'm not 100% sure I understand what the difference is. They make money on royalties and on licensing. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think those are kind of the same thing, aren't they?
Yeah. When you talk about high margin businesses, those are the ones, man.
Well, that's all they do. And they're,
I guess, don't have to make the product. I don't have to pay people to make new things. I have made some stuff and I will let you use it a little. Pay me.
It seems to be working out great. And like NVIDIA, right? Right time, right place, whatever. All of a sudden, ARM is everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. We want it in the data center. We want it in all our devices. It's in most of our devices. They're expanding into these new vertical markets, you know, automotive, et cetera. So, it's an ARM world and we're only living in it. I'm surprised they don't make more money from it, honestly. I mean, my God, given how much
there is a point at which you raise the price enough from the license perspective or the royalty perspective that think your folks go, you know, I could just
pay I'm just gonna fork this and do my own thing. For sure. It's just it's astonishing. Anyway, it's interesting.
It's $800 million for saying, okay, you can do a little and you can do a little and you can
but even like Surface has brought in more money than that in a quarter. I'm not saying profitable, but more, you know,
but for a heck of a lot more work.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. Much lower margins. Mm-hmm. And then I wasn't sure where to throw this story, but I wanted to discuss this a bit with you, Richard, because of your background here. So every year, .NET is on a yearly cadence. They release the new version of the product every November at .NET Conf. Mm-hmm. Every other year is a long-term servicing release.
3 years.
Which is 3 years, right? This year is not, or this year won't be the coming year. .NET 8 was. They usually have some big bucket focus areas for each year. They were very vague about what those might be, but there's more information coming. And then .NET has all of these like projects, right? MAUI, ASP, .NET, et cetera. And each of those groups has their own kind of pushes. So there's even things like legacy. It wasn't even really .NET, but like WinForums and WPF are still considered part of this umbrella and are largely community supported now, but they all have these kind of...
There's a Win version for WinForms for the Win SDK that is contemporary as well as the old framework versions, just to make it more confusing.
Yeah. So let me ask. So I actually got this question from three different people and I was like, I have to discuss this with Richard. Mm-hmm. Why do they do this? Why do they rev this so much?
Why, Richard? Why?
Well, I mean, in other words, you could have a stable version of .NET and you could add to it, right? I mean, why is this too fast? Am I missing something?
Well,
I didn't really have a good answer for this.
One of the problems that they had in the old framework was that companies were sticking to a given version for a decade.
Right.
So it's the back end patching that became incredibly expensive. You find a vulnerability in older versions from the older version, and you have to patch all of the versions that people might be using. So there's been a heavy push to get away from the 10-year utilization into the shorter term utilization so that they can keep rolling forward and simplify the surface area for patching.
So let me oversimplify if you don't mind. Does this just move the work from patching patching out of date, whatever, .NETs to, well, now you have to think about this, the upgrade cycle, right? For this to make sense, upgrading from one version of .NET to another has to be as seamless as possible. Right.
And so the argument is by going quicker, you encourage people to build CI/CD pipelines, like ability to just keep building testing frameworks so that they have more confidence that the new versions are going to work for them, and to not allow that software, you know, what is legacy software? Stuff you can't build anymore. And this was the joke. It was an 8-year-old piece of software running on 4.5. We found a major security vulnerability. Here's the patch for it. Nobody knows how to build it anyway.
Right. So, yeah, this thing's out running in the world. It's not something we're actively developing and or upgrading. You're right. Interesting.
And so that, you know, really getting into a place where you maintain buildable code by creating circumstances. Now, you think about it, this is what they were trying to do with Windows 10 too, the constantly new versions of Windows 10 until the system is just like, stop. But, you know, back to your core question, are they moving too fast? There's a lot of developers feeling that way. Yeah. When .NET 8 adoption wasn't that quick, still ongoing. It's only been a few months.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where it's just like, it's not that easy to just grab the next one and keep going. The only thing I think they've done that's very clever is there's a lot of drop in performance benefit for moving up.
So yeah, it does seem like every release improves reliability, performance.
We talk about the Stephen Taub missive.
Yeah.
Coming in a month or so before November, before the ship, Taub will write this monolith blog post about all of the performance tuning work they've done.
Right.
And they're real, they're double digit number performance improvements. It's like you take your app works the same, you switch from .NET 7 to .NET 8, you're this much faster.
Yep.
And so I don't know how long that, I mean, that guy is brilliant. His team's extraordinary. They can't keep doing this. You know, there's diminishing returns at some point.
Yep. It seems like the types of things that would be other than, I mean, look, I mean, obviously performance, reliability, whatever, it's great. I don't mean to say it's not interesting, but I mean, the stuff I think that's going to be compelling about .NET going forward is going to be the AI libraries and SDKs, the, you know, cross.
But largely those are Azure libraries too, right?
Yeah. Like
now we get into this is the political angle of this.
Well, you got to bring the .NET developer to that world, right? Yeah. And you provide that from
the .NET developers being asked to come. I'm making those shows, right?
Yep. Good. Okay. All right.
It's not the same team of people.
I think at some point that I don't think there'd be any pushback if they came out, you know, next year and said November or whatever, this time next year and said, look, this is a mature platform. Maybe we move to a every other year.
You know, yeah, I think you make a really valid point. It's like, when does that make sense, right?
Yeah. Yep. That's what. Okay. Interesting. I'm glad you kind of. I was struck by how the same these questions were, and I didn't have a good answer for why they would just do this every year. It's like being on a treadmill. You know.
Yeah. You know? And you know, many features can't be built in a year. So part of what's interesting talking to the team is knowing that they've been dark building features.
Nowhere near a year later. Yeah.
2, 3, 4 years. There are mega features that take a long time to be built. Right. And so they're slowly being added, but they're always continuously integrating. So it's not like they're off on a branch somewhere with a feature that takes 3 years to build and never going to be able to integrate it back in. It's all in the code base, just not lit.
Right.
And it doesn't really cost us anything. You know, if you actually care about your footprint size, you do an ahead of time compilation and it rips all that stuff out and out of your code base anyway. So, but it, you know, the quality of .NET has been better than ever because of its architectural approach and the way they're building things. The question is, how often do you declare versions? It is not, you know, we used to talk about the two styles of delivering software. There was the build to a feature ship, slip the date, and there was build to a date, slip the features.
I wonder when some guys just started talking about .NET framework, which is not the .NET we're talking about, but the at some point that will be out of support, and that's going to be a good day.
Yeah, I mean, no.
Not.
Oh, no. Because Windows has so many dependencies on 4.8. Mm-hmm. Because SQL Server has 4.8 in it. 4.8 is the end of the standard framework. And Microsoft itself is not going to be able to wean itself off. But I would point out that Windows 11 ships with the Visual Basic runtime.
That's right.
Right? From 1999.
Yeah.
So
VB run.
Yeah. It's still there.
Oh, Microsoft.
So, but surely. This craziness of, like, I just described this whole reason why you want to keep constantly up to date. But I'll tell you this, the company doesn't do it.
Right.
The Windows team isn't doing it. There are dependencies inside of Windows that are dependent, as they're talking about in the chat there, on 3.5, on 4, on 4.5, and on 4.8.
Right.
So it's not just it's there for third-party software. It's there for Microsoft.
The dependencies inside of Windows.
This is the little screen snippet there is, you know, anyone who actually looks at Windows Update will know that not only do these .NET framework updates come up a lot, they take a really long time to install. They're notably time consuming. And I think it just has something to do with the legacy nature of the code. I mean, they're not in any way efficient. And I don't see that opportunity.
Well, and the big thing is when we got to four, we got side-by-side execution. So anytime you see something involving 3-5, it's because you can't side-by-side, which is particularly brutal.
Right. I skipped over this by mistake, but I don't know. Sometime in the past month, Notion came out with their calendar app, right? And this was the old Cron app that they bought.
And they made a big deal out of that. It's ridiculous.
I know. They just, well, at the time I said, you know, okay, I've replaced OneNote with Notion. I could replace Word with Notion, honestly. Why don't you guys have a little Notion suite? Well, they just bought something called Skiff. And Skiff, there's a lot of overlap. Skiff has a Docs app that's a lot like the main Notion app. They have a calendar app, right, which is obviously. Notion doesn't sell storage, but Skiff does. So Skiff, sorry, did or does. They had their own sort of, I don't know what they were using on the back end, but they had their own kind of storage tiers. And then they have an email app, right? So email and calendar kind of go together. Fun. This is very interesting. This type of stuff, these things that are smaller, lighter, less full featured, but you know, smaller, lighter, simpler than Microsoft Office have been really interesting to me for a long time. Google Docs is a big example. All the kind of open source traditional office suites like LibreOffice and so forth. But Notion is the first one for me where I was like, okay, like this, maybe.
Is this an alternative to something? Like, that's the question, right? Really?
Yeah. Well, it's right. So there is a market out in the world for businesses that go and do things like Google Workspace and Notion and Slack, right? They're kind of plugging things together, not using one giant, you know, monolithic thing like Microsoft 365. I guess the only problem in this scheme is that those people are using Google for calendar, for email. And, you know, I don't see anyone replacing Gmail, frankly. So I don't know. I it's unclear what's happening here. This might just be two small teams coming together and saying we can be better going forward together.
We have a better, things. The question is, are people looking for an alternative to Google?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think they're looking,
Well, probably. Now we can play the insurtification game, right?
Right.
Which, by the way, I'm amazed that Dr. O seems to be penetrating in a new level of consciousness here. All us tech people have known it for ages, but I'm having like normal. Have you heard of this?
He nailed the term. So hard to brand things correctly.
It was the word of the year this in 2023.
It should be. Yeah, it was for me. And it's perfect because as soon as you explain in one sentence what it is, people are like, oh yeah, my God, they see it. And then you see it everywhere. I think I compared it to buying a car, you know, I never see like a blue, you know, Buick, whatever. And now they're everywhere. My God.
I bring that up just to say Google Docs and stuff has been running long enough now. It's fairly certified. So you have an opportunity to make a new product set, and the Notion guys can do that. It's earlier in the certification cycle.
Yeah. Well, I think it happens faster now, right? I mean, so yeah, I would say, you know, for example, I very much prefer Gmail to any of the Microsoft stuff, but one thing that they added a million years ago, and God knows when or how, but there's like a side panel now in this thing, and you can hide it, but there's a keyboard command I do by mistake all the time that opens it, and I start taking a note, I guess, or whatever it is. And if I go and look at this, it's probably like a Google Keep thing or something, I will see the beginnings of a million email replies where I am not looking at the screen, and then I realize I'm typing in the wrong thing. And that's its own little form of insurification in the sense that they want to make it really easy for you to get to meet and contacts and tasks and keep and all these stupid names that all sound the same. And I don't want any of it. I just want Gmail, you know? Yeah. So of course,
the same old problem is like they want, what's their revenue model? They have all these mechanisms around trying to get value out of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so, you know, certification seems to be stuck on the online side because the online side has this disease of just not being okay with making you just pay for it.
the thing about, yeah. So I feel like the cure for insuratification would be giving people the option to pay to not get the shit. Right. And I know it's a stupid way to say it, but we've talked to Chris Capasol for years about doing this in Windows. Hey, here's an idea. How about getting rid of all the crapware and the tracking and the ads, and I'll pay you $10 a month. They're like, oh, that would send a wrong message about, you know, that the base Windows is bad. And it's like, no, it sends a message that if you pay enough, you can have a good experience. And that's what we experience everywhere else in life. So, you know, there will always be the people that have to fly in the back of the plane or can't buy a luxury car and can't pay for the premium Google service or whatever we're talking about. That's the way of the world. I'm sorry. But right. Like I would like to get out of that where I can, where it makes sense to me, where I can afford
it. Can I buy my way out of this, or do I have to buy my way out of this?
Yeah. And unfortunately, our world has gone topsy-turvy because subscription services, which were historically had been pay for no ads, right, are now doing a combination of paying and seeing ads.
Yeah, sure.
And it's Netflix. And it's, right. Everyone's doing it. Spotify, Spotify doesn't do it. I'm sorry. Everyone's doing it. The video service is doing it. And, you know, newspapers have been doing this for years. I hate this. Like I hate it. I want one or the other. I don't anyway. Yeah. So, does what, Skiff is such a stupid name. Notion and Skiff and, Arc and these small companies, like, is there a plug and play thing of the future where you kind of just pick and choose from the services, everything interoperates? And because maybe I'm paying each of them a little bit of money, but I've created this thing that is not crappy in the way that some of the Microsoft stuff is or whatever.
Yeah, it's just in order to have all the interoperability, you have a parent, and it's typically Microsoft or an Apple. Or,
yeah, it's the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we'll see what comes out of this. It took Notion almost 2 years to turn Cron into a calendar app. Which was, you know, with their own branding. So I don't know. We don't know. They haven't said anything. In fact, there was no real formal announcement. There was just an announcement on the web, the Skiff website, that it had happened. And then when you went to Notion, it was a very short interview of the guy, the CEO of Notion, talking to the co-CEOs of the other company, co-founders, whatever. And it's just completely unrelatable. It's like, oh, we moved into the same expensive San Francisco loft that you guys used to be in. Like, we have so much in common. And like, yeah, no, I know what that's like. You know, like, makes me want to buy your products, you know? Like,
it's funny because I tried Cron maybe a year ago. You know, it's all right. It was interesting. I did not know Notion, that's Notion Calendar. I had no idea. Now that I'm looking at the website, it says Cron is now Notion Calendar. And by the way, the smallest print on the website. Yeah, interesting. I mean, Cron's a decent calendar program. So it's clear Notion is trying to build up a complete office suite. What's next? A messaging app. They don't have a...
Right.
That's the only thing missing.
No, if you want to make a processor and a spreadsheet, the commit would be run a mail service. That is a giant commit.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, with no margin.
Integrate with Gmail. That's what everybody else does, including Cron, I might...
Right.
Skiff has email, right?
They do, yeah.
Yeah. So Skiff is an email service.
I believe this Skiff stuff is all shut down, by the way. Like, I tried to sign in for a couple of days in a row, and then I read somewhere someone said, yeah, the service backend has been snipped. Like,
so they have encrypted end-to-end encrypted email. So yeah. I think they got it.
Like Proton Mail or whatever, yeah. Right?
So they're on the path.
Encryption is everything that they focus on. Mm-hmm. They have a calendar, so there's some overlap there.
Yep.
And they have file storage.
I would say, and their docs is an overlap with just Notion.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, file storage, I
bet you they bought it not for docs so much as mail and drive.
That's what
you're looking at here.
It is weird that the free tier of Notion, you could just add stuff to that forever and they're never going to ask you for money. That's never made a lot of sense to me. So, you know, at some point they're going to ask for money and maybe this is how they do it. They'll start using this as the back end and say, okay, well, this is the plan. So you get some amount of storage for free, whatever it might be. We'll see.
Very interesting.
Now, as promised, when did we start?
The most important part of the story today.
Xbox segment.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, some big news here. So I don't remember if or if we talked about this at all last week, but we must have. There's been these indications that rumors, I guess, you know, that Microsoft is going to start bringing more games to other platforms. And it bothers me. It's bizarre to me that every time this happens, you get these kind of head in the sand types that, you know, start complaining again about we're losing our identity, that Xbox without a console doesn't make any sense. They're going to get rid of the console, you know. What does it mean to be an Xbox exclusive if I can play it on the PlayStation, you know? There's some news about how well Sony's doing in the console market coming up. Mm-hmm. So I'll just say, you know what? Let's let Sony numbers. Make the consoles and don't worry about it. Because Microsoft has never once made money on hardware in Xbox. That Snofsky book I've been referencing, he called it basically a break-even business over the course of its history, meaning it probably hasn't been profitable overall, but it's probably pretty close, you know. And the thing that makes it profitable, the thing that makes it possible to be profitable is not the hardware. They've never made money on that. It's the, right. the services, which have expanded to include multiple subscription services, right? Microsoft has spent a lot of money buying studios. Not just Activision Blizzard, right? But a bunch of other studios, yep. including all the ZeniMax studios, right? And Bethesda, et cetera. I assume a lot of people looked at that and thought, they must be doing this so they can play Sony's game and have Xbox exclusives. Right. But they've never said that. In fact, they've been very clear that what they want is for Xbox to meet gamers where they are, meaning right. whatever devices they choose to use. Over 50% of the gaming market is mobile. Of the remainder, consoles are smaller than PCs, although that's pretty close. And mobile is much bigger than those two combined, though. It's, you know, so Activision Blizzard, they've tried to make the case. I don't think anyone paid attention to this, but it was mostly about getting a mobile play going. And okay. But I think really Xbox becomes that thing which Microsoft has historically been good at, which is a company that has good IP that they can license and put it out into the world, you know, and it's software service based, however you want to describe that, right? So games and game franchises. If we did talk about this, I would have talked about this notion that as an Xbox gamer, opening up these games to other platforms is good for you as well, right? This, in my case, like a Call of Duty gamer, I witnessed the explosion of gamers I could play against when they opened it up to other consoles, right? Cross play, and then to PCs in the most recent couple of generations. More people, more playing, more game. It's just better. It's better for everybody, right? It's better for Xbox as a business because they own these things and they're making money on it. And they're being profitable, right?
Right.
So. Long term, do I think that Xbox will eventually say no to hardware? Yes. But I also think that console hardware is on the decline.
Yeah.
I don't just think that it is, right?
Yeah.
We'll have some hard numbers in a moment here to kind of show you where that's heading. But the current market leader is going to be lucky to sell half as many as they sold of two generations ago. I mean, it's not even close.
They're also much more expensive devices. Like the expectation, yeah. We've hit this goofy point in the console market where the hardware has got so much power in it that it's almost not possible to make a profitable game that fully utilizes that hardware.
Yeah, I think for the companies that make the consoles and then the companies that make the games for the consoles, the expense of these things has extrapolated. They're expensive in different ways. You know, it's expensive just R&D. It's expensive to manufacture. It's expensive, you know, the whole thing is expensive.
The process of making art at, you know, the 4K HDR
right.
is just so costly.
It's Hollywood quality graphics and effects. Yeah. And it's become a tough thing. The nice thing about a cloud-based game, assuming we don't have to talk about latency and bandwidth, mm-hmm. is that you only need one computer to be really good on the back end. It can display to anything, right? So you can turn something that might be an old computer, a Chromebook, a phone, into a viable gaming machine, assuming, you know, these other conditions.
Yeah, met, I mean, right? There's an incremental cost per user, but you can play with the math around that. But latency is going to kill it.
Like, and I think, you know,
speed of light is difficult to beat.
Yeah, that's right. Short term, there's a hybrid thing. I think just like an AI, where, you know, having something locally makes sense, and do as much as you can from the cloud, et cetera. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Look, Microsoft's not going to exit the console market anytime soon, but long-term, absolutely. And maybe the other way to look at it is just if they can have enough content in the software and services bucket, that can help subsidize a losing hardware range, right? I mean, that, you know.
That would be my point. Like, it's always been a loser.
Yeah.
But are you credible in the gaming space if you don't have a device in the field, right? Like, it's in the same way that the Surface line was not really meant to make Microsoft money. It was meant to set a bar for the OEMs to make better devices.
Yeah.
There's a case to be made for keep your hand in this game. Like, if you talk about any regrets Satya might have, it's like you didn't keep a phone in the game.
Right.
Because now it's needed. Get your costs under control and you know, don't go too nuts on the innovation side, but stay in the game, maintain the pipeline of being able to build hardware because of the risk of disruption.
Okay. But the big difference between phone and like Xbox is that the quality of the content appearing on the phone was terrible and going downhill. Mm. And the big publishers.
Well, they destroyed the dev eco market. But here's my point. If you don't make a console, you are beholden to the console makers for your multi-billion-dollar gaming business. You need to be able to defend that product space.
Okay, so let me. Okay, so for many years, Microsoft's biggest partners were the PC industry, right? Obviously, I'm sure they're still one of the biggest sets of partners, and that was an argument, right? I mean, Microsoft had been asking them for years to make thin light computers without fans and yada, yada, yada. They weren't doing it. And the justification for Surface is like, we're going to show them what we meant. And maybe if we do a good enough job, they'll be inspired and follow us down this path. Okay.
And IBM also did their whole Ultrabook move. Like there was a push by the folks that would benefit from making those machines, not just machine makers, to facilitate that. And I see it the same way for this.
The issue here is that gaming is not as simple as the PC business, right? So PCs are part of it, 25% or so, whatever the number is. Yep. You know, consoles, another 25%. Smartphones are probably, you know, 50, 70, whatever, some giant percent, right?
So, but I would rather look at the revenue numbers of each of those stacks. It's just not as much. The money in mobile is much more difficult.
Okay. I mean, Apple and Google both come up with their app store numbers at the end of the year. These are humongous markets. They talk about how much they pay out. We know that the vast majority of app store revenues on both platforms is games. They're humongous, humongous.
It's just the nature of mobile gaming businesses doesn't well suit the highest market cap company in the world. It's a scummy business. It's free to play, pay to win.
That's right. Yeah, no, you're right.
Right? It is literally exploiting people.
I hear
that's
you.
How it works.
Apple is experimenting right now with, will iPhone users pay for like AAA console quality games? And then what's that experience even like? And it's not great, honestly. You know, it's there. You can see it. Like, you know, obviously in some ways these devices are powerful enough to run those kinds of things, but anyway, I maybe the way to say this, because honestly, no one's going to come up with the answer. Like, there's no answer. No. But I think the one thing we can all agree on is that gaming is changing, and there may be a future world in which Microsoft does not need a console. That world is not today. I would just say that.
So, but I would argue, like you talk about the Arc browser, like there's a room to innovate here. The number of times we played with, do you play on the phone versus playing on the PC versus playing on the console, there's an experience being waiting to happen for a really great, you know, game.
Anyway, we try different things. I think Nintendo landed on something semi-profound with the Switch that we didn't realize was a thing.
So they don't play the hardware game, which is brilliant.
Yeah. And it helps. I mean, it helps them do things. You know, if you're sitting on the couch with a phone, like an iPhone, which a gorgeous screen, like I said, you know, 4K basically quality graphics, whatever, but you want to stream it to your Apple TV on an actual 4K, it's going to fall apart right there. Like and you could run a wire, but then you're running a wire. And now if I'm doing that,
the bigger idea here is that I play on the phone when I want to play on the phone, and I flip to the console when I want to play on the console.
Yep.
That if I had the right game, Right. The right game would have a great mobile experience that allows you to pay one aspect of the game. But yes. There's some point where it's you're going to do better for that part of the game when you play it on a bigger screen with more horsepower in a console.
So this was the dream of Xbox Play Anywhere, right? This notion that it was time to go to work. So you had to put down the Xbox and take your phone with you. You could play on the bus, and maybe at night you were laying in bed with your Surface laptop or whatever and playing it there. And it was the same game, whatever.
Yeah, I just don't think the same game is a good idea. Use the form factors. Make a game where it's a distinct play experience from mobile and a distinct play experience.
I mean, I think there are games that would work, but not every game. Yeah, for sure. So, Microsoft came into last week or this month or however you want to describe it, being very clear about what they wanted to do strategy-wise. The Activision Blizzard was a $69 billion statement about exactly what they wanted to do.
How serious they were. Yeah.
Yep. And so these rumors have started coming out and people are freaking out. We used to freak out because Starfield was that game that was going to be on the PlayStation, but now it's not. And you guys are liars. And now they're like, wait a minute. Now it's like, you're going to bring Starfield to PlayStation. You're liars. I don't like what is it you want us to do that will make you all happy? We're never going to do it.
That's impossible. Somebody's going to.
So it got so bad that I think it was last Thursday or Friday. Phil Spencer went on Twitter and said, guys, we're going to talk about it. And so it's coming soon. And then, Monday, Tuesday, this past week, they issued a statement on Thursday at whatever time we're going to come out. We're going to release a podcast. We're going to talk about this. So they're going to explain their strategy.
That's tomorrow. And Thursday, right?
Yeah, tomorrow, Thursday. That's right. Now, I must have mentioned this last week.
By the way, it's already Thursday here in Australia.
Yeah. So tell us what it says. Look up, go to Microsoft.com. they were probably going to do this sometime in February, and then all this stuff leaked because they're spreading news to their partners and whoever, and someone leaked whatever happened. And so everyone's leaking things. And now it's going to happen a little earlier than they wanted. But look, we're halfway through February. They bought Activision Blizzard. We need to know what's going on there, guys. Come on. Any day now, it's almost the 15th. There's going to be second half of the month Game Pass games. And are we seriously going to go through another cycle with no Activision Blizzard games? So that has to be another big part. I assume that was, in fact, the big part of it. But the other part was, hey, guys, we just bought Activision Blizzard. We just talked for years, literally years, about meeting gamers where they are. We bought a studio that's already making games for other consoles. It came up during the antitrust stuff. People were like, oh, you're going to stop doing that? No, we're not going to stop doing that, right? It doesn't take much for Microsoft to point to what they already have and say most of what we do is actually in other places too.
Yeah.
The question is,
and by the way, our business is cloud and we don't care what the source of consumption cloud is as long as you consume our cloud.
We've had Office on the Mac for decades. We've had Office on mobile devices now for several years. We are meeting you where you are. Okay. The big question to me is A, timing and where, when, whatever of the Activision Blizzard stuff on Game Pass and which first party games, franchises, whatever, are going to start moving to other platforms. I just point out, by the way, Sony has been putting out games on PC for several years now. Mm-hmm. Is their little ecosystem freaking out over there because of this? Maybe, I don't know, but we're really thin-skinned in the Microsoft world. It's like, it's amazing how much pushback there is to common sense.
Right.
They did not spend $69 billion in Activision Blizzard to release things only on a console that nobody is buying. I'm sorry. Sorry. if that doesn't make sense to you, then I cannot help. And so we're going to learn tomorrow, Thursday, what that is. But my expectation is, we are going to find out everything I just described. Which games, when, where, whatever, right?
Yeah, I think they're pretty much going to say what you say. Hey, we're going to put it everywhere. I would argue we're not going to learn anything new tomorrow. That it's going to be
stuff
we already knew. They've already said it.
That's my argument all along has been they've been talking about this for a long time. I don't understand what the problem is. So I agree with you.
And I'll say it again.
The only thing we're going to learn is maybe some specifics with regards to particular titles or timing. But So look, I'm paying $15 a month for Game Pass Ultimate. I'd like to kind of take advantage of that. Can I get some Activision love here, please? Anything? Nobody?
Well, they managed to do some layoffs and And that leads to the
yes. So that leads to the second Xbox drama of the week, and my favorite topic, the FTC. Mm. I would point you all to my new favorite AI generated graphic, which is of a baby crying on a beach, because the baby in this story is the FTC, and
they're doing. Sure feels like sour grapes. It sure.
Oh my God! This organization, as I now call them, the Futile Trade Commission, insisting on fighting not just yesterday's battles, folks, but the battles we've already lost in court.
Repeat it. Had been told by the court, stop fighting this battle.
There was a quote I will never forget. I don't remember. I can't speak verbatim, but just the sheer nastiness of it from the judge in this case, who said, you have unearthed over 1 million pieces of evidence of documents that you purported were evidence of your claim that Microsoft was going to pull Activision or pull Call of Duty off of the PlayStation. Not a single one of these documents indicates this in any way, shape, or form. In fact, most of them contradict that, as do their public statements, as do the deals they have reached with other companies to ensure that these games continue on these other platforms. They're crazy. Like, these people are insane. Anyway, Microsoft announced some number, 1,900 jobs were being eliminated in a new business inside of their gaming unit called Microsoft. I think it's just called Microsoft Gaming, if I'm not mistaken. It is a combination of ex-Activision Blizzard and Microsoft Xbox employees. It's not everything in Xbox. I don't believe it includes all of the game studios that Activision Blizzard owned that are in different places around the world, but whatever, it doesn't matter. So some percentage of that was being laid off. And the FTC said, hold on a second. They actually issued a legal challenge saying that this acquisition should be rolled back because of this. You promised not to do this.
Did they?
That's
very unlikely.
That was the thing. I was like, that's interesting. That's interesting. I want to find that. I want to find that document because it's going to be out there, right?
You have millions of pages?
Yep. It's not out there. But what is out there is that that judge, the same judge I just misquoted, did in her ruling discuss such things as vertical versus horizontal mergers and what that means. It is interesting. Her understanding of the acquisition was that Microsoft was going to treat Activision Blizzard the way they did their, some of these other studios like Bethesda, that it would be, or Mojang, right? It would be this thing that was operated independently. But that's not what they did. They actually brought Activision Blizzard into Microsoft Gaming. And the FTC is arguing that in doing so, they're trying to make it harder and possible to roll back the acquisition later if anyone ever wanted to do that. And okay, I guess. The thing is, this is, you can't tell a company that just spent $69 billion that they can't lay off redundant employees. You know, look, we can argue about how Microsoft does layoffs. We could know or not know the details, but ideally you have these two businesses you're combining. There are going to be redundancies in marketing and advertising and HR and wherever else. Yeah. And you pick the best person for the job and the other one has to find another job or leaves and it's sad and whatever. Mm-hmm. But
I have to say it is fairly common for companies to make assertions during these trials and during these disputes about how they're going to run the company. And it's fairly common that they lie. And then as soon as the merger it happens all the time.
No, I'm not.
As soon as the merger is approved, they do what they want. And I'm glad the FTC is paying attention because in years past, they've just said, fine, go ahead, do whatever you want.
Unfortunately for the FTC, all I can speak to is what actually happened here, which is this. This is a tiny percentage of Activision Blizzard employees.
I understand, but if they made Activision the assertion Blizzard, well, during on, the hold merger hold on. Discussions that they wouldn't do I, that,
they,
then,
they, hold on.
Then they need they, to hold their feet to the fire.
Cleared. Let me complete it. Activision Blizzard was going to have layoffs if this thing fell through. Mm-hmm. Those layoffs would have been higher than the layoffs that Microsoft underwent. And Microsoft organized this new business such that if this thing is rolled back, they can let those people go and nothing changes. Like they literally organized this new company such that the Activision employees are in their own little thing inside of it. And that if, God forbid, this is rolled back. So Microsoft was able to come out. Microsoft actually had to appear in court and say, none of this matters because none of it's true. So, yeah. And that was the end of that. So, I like that the FTC, I don't like anything about the FTC, actually. I appreciate that any regulatory body has got to do some form of due diligence and all this kind of stuff, whatever. The FTC has been trying to...
that weren't actually made.
Yeah, I've never found any evidence that Microsoft said anything like this. What Microsoft, I did find was...
Right, this is from the letter. Microsoft represented to this court that the quote, so they're quoting Microsoft's representations...
hold on a second. Wait. This is the FTC.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, since we're talking about
quoting Microsoft.
Hold on. They're not quoting. They're saying Microsoft represented. What actually happened was that the judge assumed that this would be a vertical merger and that these things would be kept separately. And that because that was, but well, this was not
you obviously
the
haven't
reason.
Read the letter from the FTC.
No, I did. I quoted from it.
Okay. So they're quoting Microsoft, not the judge.
Okay. Look, the FTC has I'm sorry. But my point is this. The thing you're quoting from is the FTC. It doesn't link to something that you can go look at that Microsoft did say this. When the FTC started this process,
it does. It says ECF 23 opposition injunction pending appeal.
Okay.
At 24.
Which is the judge's.
Also,
I know. I went lately. I wrote about this. If you go to the original document, it's the judge who says it, and the FTC when they started this process of complaining about this acquisition, the very first thing that they did to enter into evidence was they claimed that Microsoft lied to the EU. To get the EU in an attempt at the time the EU had not approved it, to get the EU to approve the deal. Microsoft never did that. In fact, it was such a lie that the EU had to issue a public statement that never happened. The FTC is the party that has been lying here, not Microsoft. So the point is, regardless of who said what happened was Microsoft organized this business in such a way that should it be rolled back, they can do it without hurting the business and everything's fine. So this particular complaint, it like most of their complaints, frankly, like their worries about Call of Duty or their worries about cloud gaming is nonsense. It's nonsense.
Okay.
So
how they became this incompetent.
These
are representatives of the people.
I know.
From predatory business practices.
This is the
Why
thing.
Why do they suck?
Right. We pay these people to protect us against companies behaving illegally or at least in some kind of belligerent fashion toward consumers or whatever, right? This deal has absolutely many things that need to be looked at and we're done. But they're still trying to roll it back. And it freaks me out the lengths that they will go to.
Seems very
to make claims that all you have to do is look at them. So yeah, I like I said, when I wrote about this, I looked at this thing they said. I said, okay, let me find this thing. What did they say? And yeah, the judge in her ruling says, you know, this is not the reason she tossed aside the FTC complaint. It's not the reason, but it is in a list of things where she said this and this and this. But ultimately, what it was the FTC's fears that Microsoft will make these games less inclusive to other platforms is not supported by evidence, nor does it make any business sense for Microsoft. It makes no sense.
Well, that's
their
not
central
what this
argument.
Is about. This is about Microsoft misrepresenting what they're going to do with the company their merger thing. Well, but you keep bringing up this game thing. This
no,
is a specific
okay.
issue.
Let me bring
about
up. Then
layoffs.
Let me again bring up the thing that addresses that concern. Microsoft organized Activision Blizzard within Microsoft in such a way that it can be rolled aside if required by law. So the concern here is that Microsoft supposedly put this stuff together in such a way that it will be impossible to take Activision Blizzard and put it back together again. And that's not true.
Has the court ruled on the letter from the FTC?
The court doesn't. There's no ruling on it. It's a file. It's a legal complaint.
Okay.
Oh, has the no?
Has
I mean,
there
oh,
been any action on the legal complaint?
No.
Okay. So we'll wait and see that.
No, not
how that works out.
Yep.
Yeah. There's no way you could make the promise not to lay anyone off and actually, you know, have the shareholders not immediately fire you. That's not how you acquire companies. It's not a thing.
There's no version of $69 billion spent, thousands and thousands of people redundant, and we have to keep them all. Yeah. That's crazy.
Well, and if you made that promise, you would be fired.
No one made that promise.
Because you can't make that promise. It's not something you can make.
Right.
Well, you could cynically make the promise, hoping the FTC will approve the merger, knowing that you're not going to do it.
Well,
it happens all the time.
No, but if you make that promise, the shareholders are freak out. That's bad fiduciary governance.
I really don't understand. Well,
there's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge in all of this. From Microsoft. We're not going to do that. But look, it happens all the time. AT&T did it. Time Warner did it.
But
Xfinity did it.
This was not what the FTC was complaining about. This wasn't the FTC complaint. They weren't worried about losing jobs at Activision Blizzard. They weren't worried that Microsoft was going to roll Activision Blizzard into the company or not. This was never part of that discussion. They had two concerns: that Microsoft was going to keep Call of Duty from Sony, which was a Sony-invented stunt that they fell for completely, and that Microsoft was going to somehow control this new market for cloud gaming, which does not exist as a viable market yet and might never. And that second complaint was the same one that the CMA had. Those guys were in league on that. They literally partnered to come up with these arguments. And in both cases, those arguments were always nonsense. And since this court case concluded, before the acquisition was consummated, Microsoft reached a 10-year deal to keep Call of Duty on PlayStation. Plus, all the public statements to, we're not going to spend $69 billion on this thing and keep it away from its biggest platform. They're going to have an event tomorrow where they talk about why they're bringing stuff to other platforms. In the Xbox world, what we're worried about is the exact opposite of what the FTC is worried about. These things are not compatible. The FTC's claims are crazy. And the fact that they're going after it after they lost is not just like historically unprecedented, because it is, but it's crazy. They do not have an argument that makes sense.
I'm just hoping this comes down to an individual in the FTC that needs
when you really an individual like Lisa Khan, you mean? I don't know.
You guys are nuts. You're driving me crazy. This is their job. When a company represents that they're going to run the business, the merged business, in a certain way, but and then does not,
that's not
it's
what
the
did.
FTC's job to return and say, Your Honor, they're not living up to the agreement. Now, the only dispute at this point is what Microsoft's representations were. The FTC seems to think very clearly that they made those representations. You have yet to show me that they did not. You just assert they did not.
Excuse me. What I said was that Microsoft responded to the charge by saying, we integrated them into our business in such a way that we could separate them.
I understand.
Cleanly.
But what were the representations they made before, during the argument
document
about
that,
whether
the link that you're
have.
Talking about links back to the ruling from that Judge Corley, where she said that Microsoft
it's the FTC's responsibility if a company reneges on a promise they made prior to the merger approval, that if the company does not keep their promise, they should not pursue that. You agree they should pursue that, yes?
Absolutely.
If that's what happened.
So let's wait and see what the court says. Because if you're right,
well,
well, that's BS. They never said that. I suspect that's not what's going to happen.
Okay. Well, I can tell you what's not going to happen.
I don't know if that's true.
Okay. All right. Well, the judge is not going to roll back the acquisition because of a disagreement over vertical and horizontal
markets. They're going to say to Microsoft, you got to adhere to the agreements you made.
I don't think
prior
they are because
to
I think
approval.
Microsoft already said that they are and explained how.
No, Microsoft's weaseling around saying, well, this isn't exactly what we do. Of course, that's their argument, but right. I think you're assuming.
Unless you can come up with the quote where Microsoft made this promise.
Well, I think we'll find out in court.
I think we'll find out in court.
I won't wait.
I guess we will. But
yeah.
Here's the thing. Hold on.
But I don't. It's irresponsible to say they're lying. This is a renegade lawyer in the FTC. The FTC is a horrible agency.
That's what the judge said, Leo.
What did the judge say to them?
There we go.
What did the judge say to them?
I don't understand why I have to keep.
So the judge has responded to this letter?
No.
Okay, so the judge didn't say that.
When the FTC lied about Microsoft's representation.
I said, hey, you lied about these representations.
Okay, so you're relitigating something from the past.
No, the FTC is relitigating. That's the point. The FTC brought, the FTC attempted to block this merger for very specific reasons. It had nothing to do with the future structure of Activision Blizzard. That was not a prerequisite. It had nothing to do with it. It was out of fear that Microsoft would control cloud gaming, which is ridiculous, and would take games away from other platforms.
You're putting words in their mouth. We don't know.
No, I'm not. If that was the complaint.
Yeah, but if Microsoft, for some reason, randomly said, "Oh, we're not going to reorganize the companies; they're going to be a subsidiary," that is a concession made to the FTC in order to get merger approval. They are bound by that.
Okay, hold on a second. If the judge said, the only reason I'm allowing this is because Microsoft said, we are not going to integrate this company into Xbox for some reason, that's the only reason I'm going to allow this, then we could have a discussion about that. That was never part of the discussion. That had nothing to do with why this merger was approved by the judge. That had nothing to do with it.
I think there's a reasonable dispute over what Microsoft did and whether it adheres or doesn't adhere to the agreement that they made. Microsoft says, no, that's not something we agreed to. FTC says it's something we agreed to. I think it'll be decided in court. I think it's
okay.
Not.
All right.
They're trying to get companies to stick to their agreements. All I know is I lived this case for two years,
and this was not
a point of contention. Yeah, but you don't
No, you never liked it. But I paid a lot of attention to it, and I wrote a lot about it, and I read a lot of those court documents, and this was never part of the argument. This was not a debate about a reason Microsoft should or should not be able to acquire this company. You're talking about relitigating. This is what the FTC is trying to do right now. They're trying to find some little, like, oh, it's like, wait, this is this over here and this is this over here. See, the whole thing gets thrown out. It's like, no, you came here with these two ideas.
That's how you characterize it. I would characterize it as them doing their job.
Well, yes.
I hope you would agree that this is their job. And I would hope you would also agree that they need to do this job. These companies steamroll over consumers and other companies all the time.
Listen,
and the only watchdog besides the U.S. Congress, which is,
we agree 100% on that,
is the FTC.
Okay. But the steamrolling aspect of this deal would include such things as competitive and consumer harm. Microsoft's stated goal all along, and I think the thing they're going to repeat tomorrow, is that our goal is to bring these games to more gamers, not less. In fact, this is sort of, Richard told the story about, Maker's Mark, where they were never going to age whiskey, but it took the Suntory company to come in, this giant conglomerate, and say, guys, there's a market for this stuff here. Activision was never going to get into subscription services. They were never going to do anything like Game Pass. And this is something that's going to bring those games to more people. So it doesn't mean the whole thing is okay. I'm just saying it's an example of something where, yeah, giant steamrolling big tech company. Everyone hates these guys. I get it. But they have enough money to, bring these games to more gamers. And it's something Activision Blizzard wasn't going to do.
Yeah, you're in favor of this merger. That's fine. They got the merger.
I am, because I've evaluated it for what it is. It's not because it's Microsoft and I love everything they do. You know, I'm not like that. I mean, I complain about big tech all the time.
I want to defend the FTC because I think it's really important that you not cast aspersions at them, that they're not acting.
Oh, no.
They're acting in bad faith is really problematic because it's the last.
I'm not assuming. I want to be really clear about this. I'm not assuming this. They are acting in bad faith, in my opinion. Antitrust regulators play a huge role, an important role. And in the United States in particular, they've let that thing sit silent for 10 years while all these big tech monopolies have occurred. This is a huge problem. There's no doubt about it. But when I look at these things on an individual basis, the FTC is irresponsible by not going after these more bigger problems that we have in big tech than this. And I guess we could look at any individual case and say, okay, this one makes sense, this one doesn't, whatever. Historically speaking, like I said, there is no precedent for them losing in federal court and still trying to litigate it.
I don't think they're trying to.
They've never done that
before. The merger. This is not about that. This is saying you made some agreements and you're not adhering to them. And I think that that's appropriate for them to do because companies do this all the time. In the past, they haven't been held to the fire. I think that's a good
thing. But I just explained Microsoft answered it, and their answer makes sense.
Oh, okay, fine.
Let's not bother them.
Let's go ahead. Microsoft said it was okay.
No, never mind. So I don't I don't know what's the process. Like
a judge will now be ruling on it.
I'm sorry. You misunderstand. The FTC sees a news story that Microsoft is laying off 1,900 people. Among those people are some people from Activision Blizzard. We don't actually know what the number is, but whatever. And they say, you know, I thought you guys said that you were going to do what? Not lay off people? What led to this?
That's a reasonable query.
But who do you ask? Do you actually approach Microsoft?
No, because
and say, hey, what's going on here?
Because they're the defense in this action. You approach a court, and I presume a court will rule. And you know what? If the court says that you're full of it, FTC, Microsoft's doing exactly what they agreed to, then I will say, absolutely, you were right. The FTC had no merits. Let's wait and see what the court says.
This is, the FTC, like I said, tried to block this, went to court, lost in the most egregious way imaginable. It wasn't close. I mean, you got to go look at this ruling. It was incredible. They ripped the FTC to shreds. There was no evidence. So now we're going to kind of pedantically look at something after the fact and say, well, see. But none of this proves their point. None of this has anything to do with why they tried to block this merger.
Yeah, but they're not saying that. They're saying you made some agreements and you're not...
Aren't they?
No.
What does it say?
It's saying that Microsoft made some assurances that this would not happen, and now it's happening. Now I think it's time for a judge to say, well, what are the assurances Microsoft made? What did they do? Does this measure up? That's not trying to stop the merger or roll the merger back. It's just saying you got to agree. When a company agrees to do something,
but it is,
in order to get a merger through, you've got to hold their feet to the fire.
But
we'll stop. But I mean, there's no point.
Maybe you understand that's what they're trying to do.
You and I disagree.
No, we don't. There's no disagreeing on this. That is what they're trying to do. They're trying to roll back the merger. That's their aim. That's
said as much.
That's literally what they're doing. That is the point of this.
Okay, that's
right.
Okay, I don't know. Right, fine.
No, it says it right. You can read the quote for yourself.
They say we want them to stop the merger.
The need for injunctive relief pending completion of the administrative proceeding. The administrative proceeding is the unprecedented legal action that the FTC has taken internally to try Microsoft privately after losing in federal court. In other words,
what are you reading layoffs, that from? What is that from?
This is the FTC filing that you're quoting from that you think has all the answers.
But what you just said, what was that from?
It's the last line. It says the reported layoffs. They don't even know if these layoffs are true. They read about it in the news. Right. But anyway, the layoffs. Well, yeah, we all agree the layoffs are true.
You ask the judge, can you rule on this? That's what you do. They're doing their job for you to imply that they're somehow being petulant.
I want to stick to the thing you just said. Stick to the point. You said this has nothing to do with them wanting to roll, but this says explicitly this is what it is. These layoffs underscores our need, the FTC's, for injunctive relief, meaning rolling back the merger, pending the completion of the administrative proceeding, our internal trial. After losing in federal court, the FTC has, for the first time in its history, decided they're still going to try to prevent this merger from happening, even though it already happened.
Oh, okay.
It says this explicitly right here.
Okay.
That's what that means.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, instead of going after Apple and Google and Amazon and whatever, they're trying to retry a case. Not trying to. They are going to retry a case they already lost.
Right.
That's why I'm upset about it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. They shouldn't be trying to reverse the merger, but I do think they should keep Microsoft to make sure it keeps its agreements.
On that, I agree. And I would say my issue only is that it's the FTC, and this is what they're really trying to do. So, yes, look, Leo, I hope you know me well enough to know. Big fan of antitrust, big fan of big tech being held to the fire, big fan of reversing insurtification. We talk about this all the time, right? This particular case, though, as big as it is, it's already been tried. Microsoft made the concessions they needed everywhere in the world to ensure that this was as
fine.
Then positive an outcome can be for everybody.
The Ninth Circuit will then say, you know, it's over, it's done. Stop trying to relitigate this.
There you go.
Let's see.
I don't know that. Let's I don't know what federal court can do to prevent the FTC from doing their internal trial. I don't know. Like, I don't know enough about the, you know, the structure of these organizations to even know if they can do anything about that.
Oh, well, but the FTC has, in fact, turned back other mergers after the merger is completed. So it's not the first time that would have happened.
Yeah, but they've never tried to do it after losing. Yeah. In federal court. Yeah. So that's unprecedented. Anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't want to argue about that, but I think the point is
that the Xbox section would be the dramatic section.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
I did. But I think the only thing that bothers me about this debate is that I actually think Leo and I are on the same page.
Yeah, I just want to defend the FTC. I really think it's irresponsible to imply that the FTC is acting
in general, it would be irresponsible to suggest that any antitrust regulator was acting whatever, you know, in this case, because they have this motive. I think this agency's off the rails, and I think this is all political. Unfortunately, they were given the mandate by the Biden administration to go after big tech. And you know, look, what happened in the past happened. So it's like they've just been really aggressive on anything new. And look, this $69 billion that warranted a lot of scrutiny, no doubt about it. But that scrutiny, you know, kind of came once to the test of federal court. And this is what they're focusing on now. It sort of blows my mind. And the very language of that filing we've been reading from, I think kind of supports the notion that they're coming at this from a very, uneducated
strange spot.
It's a very strange place. And it's like they didn't learn the lesson of, you know, maybe if you're going to make an accusation, have some evidence. You know, the FTC could have gone to Microsoft and said, we'd like to have some more information about this layoff that you're doing. We want to know how many people are from Activision Blizzard. We want to know how many from Microsoft. We want to know the structure of this Microsoft gaming unit you just announced that has people from Activision Blizzard in it. Is there anything in here that keeps you from meeting the, you know, your legal requirements from this ruling? I find it weird that they just issued a legal. That's what I meant by process. I'm not sure this is the right process, but I don't know. I really don't know. I just know that this agency has been off the rails against Microsoft, and I don't understand it. The UK CMA was exactly the same way. And the fact that these guys were explicitly partnering on those cases, I think is telling, but you know, whatever. Yeah. So I have a problem with that, but look at the EU. Look how amazing those people have been, dealing with big tech in a logical and kind of legally defensible fashion. And look at the change they've instituted. Meanwhile, we got the FTC is worrying about some hundreds of people from Activision Blizzard in a vertical and or horizontal merger that was already approved by federal court. Jesus. I mean, there are important things happening in the world. I just doesn't feel like one of them. That's my only point. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to argue the point too much. Okay. Let's move on to fun stuff. Sony and their cratering console business. Yeah. Unfortunately,
Is that an exaggeration? Is that really a crater?
Yeah, it is a crater, sadly. So I think the console business is going downhill, and I'll support that with some numbers. But this is kind of the market leader in the sense that it's like Sony and Xbox only, really. They've been 2 to 3 times the sales of Xbox for last couple of generations. They predicted for this fiscal year, which ends in March, end of March, they were going to sell 25 million units, which after the October quarter ended would have required a Christmas miracle. They tried to pull it off by overspending on ads and promotional sales for the product. They ended up having the greatest quarter the PlayStation's ever had. They sold, I think it was 8.2 million units, but they fell short by over a million of what others expected and several million short of what they needed. And now they're going to fall short for the fiscal year, which we all kind of saw coming October, November anyway. The problem is they're looking at the future and they're like, yeah, this is the end game. Sony's come out explicitly and said, we're winding this down. Like They have no big franchise games coming out in the next fiscal year. There's nothing major happening. They're going to kind of manage the end of this life cycle. So we don't know what that means to Xbox exactly, because we don't have Xbox, you know, numbers, but, you know, again, consensus was that Sony was much higher. Where are they now? They have said explicitly they sold about, I did the math and came up with 58 million, but according to Sony, it's about 50 million sold through consoles. This thing, we're going to see declining, you know, the console sales decline from here on out. This may end up being, almost certainly will end up being, their lowest selling PlayStation console of all time. And the numbers go like this. We know that the best one was the PlayStation 2, 155 million units, probably higher. We didn't have a good measuring way to measure that back then, I guess. PlayStation 4 was around 120. PlayStation 3, about 88, right? And the original PlayStation was a little over 100. I don't see them reaching 88. I don't see them reaching, honestly, 65. I think this thing kind of peters out.
It's very expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I think it just got to a point where it's like, it's not a kid's toy anymore. It's a $5, $6 device.
The problem is, like, Sony has done a pretty good job over the years of reducing costs of the course of a life cycle and making money on hardware, right? Nintendo does a great job on this as well.
You speak to an important point. Like, how many versions of PS4 was there? 5?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Microsoft's done the same thing where they release like a new version of the console and it looks kind of new and fun, but it's really there because it costs them less to make, right? That's the point. You have fewer chips and, you know, whatever, cheaper plastics, whatever it is. But they said in this earnings release, like, we're having trouble doing this. Like, it's, these things are expensive to make, and, you know, they did the supposed thin version, right? It wasn't that much thinner. It wasn't any cheaper.
Well, and the other side of this is there's another generation coming. There should be a PS6, except that we can't fully utilize the PS5. Like, it has too much horsepower as it is.
I actually expect that. So Nintendo's this year will release a new Switch, right? A new console. I think they're going to call it a Switch 2 or something. You know, I think it will play all the old games. It will have better graphics and blah, blah, blah.
It's not Nintendo's tendency, but maybe.
They've indicated a desire. No, they've said explicitly, we're working it through, but we want to figure out a way to bring games forward. Like, we want to, you know, because they see what Xbox has done, I think, and they like that part of it. I think gamers would like it. They make money selling hardware. So selling people a hardware upgrade in their case makes sense. And, you know, video games are like Star Wars movies. Every time a new version comes out, people buy them again. And, you know, I think they've got a good market for that. So I think it would make sense for Sony to call something the PlayStation 6 and have it be dramatically better and yada, 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 but have it be fully backward compatible. And maybe in the past they might have called it a PlayStation 5 Pro or, you know, whatever the terminology might be. I don't, you know, we'll see. And Microsoft's probably going to do the same thing. Honestly, we saw those rumors last year about the redesigned S and X tiers of those consoles. And, you know, we'll see. But I was joking earlier. If you thought I was happy about this, I was not. I mean, this is a little alarming. The stuff that Sony looks to the future that looks good are things like active accounts across PlayStation. Yeah. And then they talk about shifting to attractive premium services, right? In other words, this is the one thing that Microsoft seems to have gotten right up with Xbox. And Sony, you know, they've had PlayStation Plus and PlayStation whatever for a while, but their subscriptions actually decreased, by the way. They didn't, they decreased in, was it profits? Decrease in profits? I can't remember if it was a decrease in numbers or decrease in profits. I think it was a decrease in numbers, but maybe an increase in profits because it was more, they're more expensive now or something like that, But that business to me is kind of flat. I think Sony needs a big cross-platform play as well. And so it'd be kind of interesting after all the Activision Blizzard complaints, after, you know, whatever happened with this generation of consoles underperforming, I think we can all agree, if Sony kind of came out and became a lot like Xbox, you know? No, I mean, I They're already doing PC. It wouldn't make sense for Sony to put games on Xbox because the console, because it's just maybe too small. But it would make sense to put them on mobile to have a bigger mobile play, right? And that's what Microsoft's been talking about. So we'll see.
Well, he said Nintendo hit this perfectly with the Switch to make a really great.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that, I mean, that console also winding down, right? But they...
But you're Nintendo's having a conversation about, is this the end of console gaming?
Well, I've always liked where consoles landed. I know you feel very strongly about the PC, for example. I feel like the future... I think the thing that will kill consoles will just be some mobile something, you know?
I just think it's a different gameplay style,
Yeah, yeah.
I like playing on my PC because I have a 43-inch 4K that I'm sitting three feet from, right? Why would I want to sit 10 feet from my 80-inch screen with a controller whose batteries are failing? When I'm going to have a good keyboard and mouse and a nice big screen
to play. Well, I that's like a personal preference. I mean, I hear you. I would just say, gaming overall has gone the way all personal computing has gone, which is that we used to sit in a room in front of a certain screen. That was all we had. And now we can be anywhere out in the world and play games and our computer.
It's just a different kind of play.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But I mean, I wonder if it always has to be. I don't know. So I think mobile has kind of laid waste to the traditional markets, for all these things, really.
Well, the race to the more and more powerful console hit this interesting limit where the game designers were having a tough time utilizing the thing in the first place. And at the same time, the market said, it's good enough 4.5-inch screen.
Yeah. Well, I can, my 57-year-old eyes, I think they are.
Tell you that too, friend.
4 inches is about the size of a pixel to me. So that doesn't help.
Yeah. So, but I think it's that. You get that combination of forces where, and I don't, Nintendo is also the one that consistently demonstrates that photorealism doesn't necessarily make a fun game.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. So I think in some ways we're getting a rationalization of gaming. Like there was just a race to recreate reality on these hugely powerful and expensive and consumptive machines. And in the meantime, fun was somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We've compared Nintendo to Sony in the past. I think Nintendo has tapped into something that I don't think Sony or Microsoft could ever tap into. It's just it's a hard thing to explain. Yep. You couldn't explain it to an investor and say, this is why you want to, own part of my company, because they would look at you like you were insane, but it happens. And you look at it, you're like, wow, they've done something special there.
Yes.
Microsoft tried this a million years ago. I remember with the first Kinect and the, Nintendo had like the little Wii guys and Miis or whatever. And we had our own stupid version. And it just
in some ways it's like both Sony and the rest of the gaming industry is soaked in that bro culture. And Nintendo resisted that. It was
It's the first person shooter, aggressive, super realistic.
We are going to take three-dimensional soundscapes of the cocking of every kind of rifle in this game mindset versus, Mario's got a mustache.
There are articles out in the world that are from gaming publications where they bring in an arms expert to look at weapons in a Call of Duty game or whatever and explain to you how real they are not, really there.
There's a cultural element that shows up there in these kinds of games. And in a lot of ways, it feels burned out.
Yes.
And Nintendo, and in the meantime, it's like, well, then gaming's burned out. It's like, then you go look over to Nintendo and go, no, it's not.
Right. This is the wall I ran into a year ago, right? It was almost exactly a year ago where I said, I have an unhealthy relationship with this thing. It's the same thing over and over again, and it doesn't feel like it's good for me.
No, it's like it's culturing this body chemistry that's unhealthy.
Yeah, and
your physical reactions to
it. You do it because it's an addiction, and what you forget is that remember this used to be fun. I think that's the thing Nintendo is able to capture. I look at those games and I think they're goofy, but a new Mario game comes out and they sell 10 million of them right away. Yep. Like, it's, you know, there's a huge market for that stuff.
No, and I had a very dear friend of mine who's never been a gamer, but her husband is. It's like, I really want to play. I want to get into gaming enough to be able to play with him. What should I play? Sure. And I steered her towards Zelda.
I
know you don't like, you don't like dramatic violence. You don't like photorealism. You don't like, and you can carry a Switch around. And freaking Zelda Call of the Wild is just a beautiful
I've never game. Done this, but for years I've been talking about, at the time it was like my wife, my daughter, just my wife, and like sitting down and say, look, we're going to together play a game like Firewatch, which is just a slow boil, you know, kind of a mystery story. It's just an interactive story, you know.
Yeah, playing a movie.
It's not about reflexes and doing things at the right time. There's some puzzles, but really it's just about an unfolding story, and you walk around this landscape and weird things happen. There's something to be said after a busy day, detuning with stupid TV because you let your brain rest a little bit. But I think there are advantages to playing games and to engaging parts of your brain a little bit, yeah. You know? So it doesn't have to be a military shooter, you know?
No, necessarily. That whole adrenaline rush side of gameplay, which is, you know, can also be a release as well, as opposed to talking about it, games like Minecraft and Kerbal Space Program, the kind of games where you tend a garden, tend a space that you have created.
Yeah. Anyway,
what you want from a game?
There are kind of these horror games that probably have the same. It's kind of a weird thing to say, but almost like a healing effect. Like a horror movie, because you see things happening to other people that are terrible, that are worse than anything that will ever happen to you, and it kind of makes you feel better about your own life. You know, they get kind of a weird psychology. But anyhow, okay. Speaking of Disney, Disney, in a kind of a curious move, I think, invested $1.5 billion in Epic Games, the foil of Apple Computer, Disney's biggest, you know, kind of fan, and, you know, I don't know what they are, partners or whatever. So that's kind of interesting. And I guess the idea here is, I'm sure they looked at, they own Marvel, but they have Marvel and they have Star Wars and they have these big franchises. And they're seeing the same thing that Netflix sees, although I don't think Netflix has been particularly successful so far, where there's this market for video games is humongous and its content. It's kind of thing we were just talking about. And maybe we need to get into this too. And that maybe there will be future Disney franchise games. And you know that you could see something like that maybe chipping away at some of the success that Nintendo has, right? So kind of
they're just also positioning this idea that the walled garden app store is in jeopardy, and so one would be
this is the
wise
time to
position yourself elsewhere as well, just to hedge your bets. It's Disney. It's not that much money, billion and a half.
Right. Oh, well, I mean, you might have. So Disney maybe has been looking at this for a long time, and maybe one of the things that held them back was, you know, most of the market is mobile.
Yep.
Most of the market is these companies that are taking 30% chunk out of everything. That doesn't make sense financially. But if this starts to fall by the wayside, hold on a second. That changes the calculus quite a bit.
And quite a bit. And we get there quick, so we don't have to race after the fact.
Yep. So I'm just speculating there. I have no idea why they're doing it, but it is interesting. $1.5 billion in Epic Games, I mean, of all companies. So.
Yeah, it's a small company. From a giant company that can afford that kind of money.
Yeah, very interesting. And then I'm just going to throw this one out there because I, when you think about Microsoft's big games, there's always these events they do with Minecraft where, like, the most recent one was Godzilla's in Minecraft. No, you know, you can bring anything to Minecraft and it's kind of fun. They're starting to do this with Flight Simulator, and I'm like, I don't know what to think of this. So, Flight Simulator, obviously, super realistic. You know, that's kind of the shtick there. You talk about like gun experts looking at weapons in Call of Duty or whatever. There are, you know, airplane experts looking at airplanes in this game, and they are perfect. They're meant to be perfect. I can't say that this is the first time they've done something like this exactly, but they are releasing an expansion pack for Flight Simulator that is based on the Dune movies, right? Because part two is coming out, I think, next month.
Imminently, yeah.
Yeah, and okay.
And there's some fun flying machines in that version.
Yeah. So you get this new planet, obviously Arrakis, and there's new types of aircraft, those kind of weird kind of
dragonfly. Everybody's looking for a new way to promote their movie. This is clever.
Yeah. It's just interesting. Microsoft's like, all right, you know.
Yeah, why not?
You know, and I
again, Microsoft's trying to be in the public gestalt.
Yeah.
That a major movie brand wants to associate themselves with Microsoft.
Yeah. It's better than the typical Xbox partners in the broader world, which usually companies like Monster Drinks or Doritos or Oreo cookies or whatever.
Yeah.
Like this is at least not unhealthy. And, you know, and again, speaking very vaguely, but in the sense of reaching gamers where they are, you could sort of maybe, you know, like Taylor Swift brought in more people to watch the Super Bowl than has ever happened in history. Maybe this will bring in, it's not going to be as big as that, but I mean, bring in some audience to gaming that might not have otherwise even looked at this game.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Maybe. I'm sure.
Yeah. That's and then anything that puts Microsoft brand in front of not just the geeks,
right,
is good for Microsoft. They've been trying to do that for quite a while.
Yeah. So that seems, you know, it's okay. It's cool. Not my thing, but it's cool.
You're listening to Windows Weekly. Paul Thrott, Richard Campbell. We're going to get to the back of the book now. Back of the book time. Paul Thrott kicks things off with a tip of the week.
Yeah, the tip of the week is petition the FTC. No, I'm sorry. Is to
don't get me started.
Don't do it.
If you want to shill for a giant mega tech corporation, you can write it. Yes. It's not on my network.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I would never. Well, would I? No. Could I get paid enough? Maybe. Not here. Okay. I don't actually have a tip, but I do have three picks, and one of them is actually kind of a non-pick. So I mentioned DuckDuckGo up front. So we talked about some web browser stuff. This is an alternative privacy-focused browser that I think could become pretty popular, but they're moving so slow, and I wish they would get kind of moving on stuff. They implemented a bookmark password sync functionality in the latest version of their desktop browser, and I'm looking at this thing, and I'm like, this looks awfully familiar, and it's because it's exactly the same way that Brave does it. Instead of having an account, there's no account in the sky that could be hacked or anything like that. You use a QR code, you put it onto a different device or a code of some kind, a one-time code. And Dashlane works this way, the password manager, if you use their passwordless version of the service, and you you add devices over time, and then you use another device to okay the next device, that kind of thing. This is a good system. It works great on Brave. But you know, they don't have some basics still, right? They don't have extension support. By the way, I don't know if you knew this, DuckDuckGo, let me make sure I get the right browser. DuckDuckGo has a password manager built in, like browsers do, that they partnered with Bitwarden to create. That's how they did it. Yeah. Interesting. So now they have this, it's not from Brave, but a Brave-like, and other companies do this too. Syncing capability for bookmarks and passwords. And what they need is extensions. They are Chromium based, so that should be pretty straightforward. It hasn't happened yet. And they need just some basic features they don't have. Like you can't pin tabs, or things like that. Like there's some stuff you people use in other browsers. So anyway, baby steps, they're getting there. I do like the look of the browser. I love the company. So interesting. This sounds like a curious choice, but Apple this past week released in stable Apple TV Plus, Apple Music, and an app called Apple Devices for Windows in the store. They collectively replace iTunes, although oddly, there's a new version of iTunes too. When these things came out in preview a year or so ago, whenever that was, I looked at them and determined that they were very clearly just iTunes with a new front end. Like they were really awful, terrible apps.
Right.
And so I downloaded these things. This is a new version of iCloud too. I just grabbed that. And I just to look at them, knowing full well, these things would just be crappy iTunes, you know, whatever's. And they're not actually. I mean, I'm not saying there's not any iTunes code in there at all, but they're actually kind of thinner, lighter, better looking, modern Windows apps. If you're in the Apple entertainment world, and a lot of people kind of are, actually, when I buy movies, I buy them on Apple. So these apps are pretty good. I'm surprised to say that. So this may open the door to Apple Music and Apple TV Plus to a bigger audience of Windows users. Maybe, you know, they're worth looking at. I was surprised they weren't as crappy as the preview versions. It feels like Microsoft helped them. Like they feel like modern Microsoft Windows 11 apps, like the media player app, the modern version, which doesn't connect to any online services or do anything special, but it's a good example of like a modern app from a UX perspective. They have that vibe to them there. It's kind of interesting. And then Microsoft also released quietly, thank God, something called Microsoft PC Manager do not download this or use this app. This is from Microsoft China. It's, I don't know how it got into the store. It is, it's like CC Cleaner, but with a Microsoft logo on it. A lot of English is a second language stuff in there. I wouldn't ding them for that exactly, but there's a lot of duplicative UI, duplicative features across it, features in the app that are already in Windows that they use it. Yet again, like we now with this app have, by my count, something like 17 different ways in Windows to control which apps run when you sign in or start up the computer, however you want to call it.
Right.
It is, other people have looked at it and said, you know, this thing is actually sending data back to China. There's tracking going on. Like this is, so if you see this out in the world, don't.
I gotta imagine this will be out of the store soon. Like this seems like nobody's, it's not
good. I don't know what they're thinking. It's foisted as a sort of, you know, improve the performance of your computer kind of thing. Other people looked at it and said, actually, if you follow this thing's advice, you're going to decrease the performance of your computer. Like this is not, I don't know. It looks, it's terrible. It's a terrible app.
Really interesting.
So it's my pick this week, everybody. Enjoy.
It's quiet and reliable.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Should we talk a little run as. Episode 919. Emily Mancini come back for her second visit. The show we called Maximizing Metadata. This has been an ongoing theme because it's we're at this co-pilot time where suddenly all the data in your organization is going to be analyzed by a large language model, and Microsoft casually says every so often, well, just make sure your data estate is in order, which is an incredibly huge bill to cover, right? Like that's just not an easy thing to pull off. And so trying to tackle that problem, I wanted to engage with Emily. She's talked in this area before, really on the SharePoint side, which is also Teams. Teams is a shell over SharePoint, actually, under the hood. And so just getting into this routine of how we mark up our data in a way for its sensitivity, areas that it's supposed to be available to, you know, those sorts of things, which leads you down this path of having better data governance when you are going to incorporate the copilots and likely things into that. But it also helps with search. Helps with organization. So it's a subtle, small thing, but when done well, makes a huge difference for a company. And there was a great conversation about some of the tooling that's around and how it can really help you as an administrator do a better job for your company in keeping that data organized.
Let's do some brown liquor. What do you say?
Would you like to? Because yeah. Here I am in Australia. This was like actually a gift. When a friend of mine in the area is like, hey, I got this for you. And so this is the Starward, particularly their Pedro Jimenez cask, which is interesting because it's not actually bottled directly by Starward per se. Starward is kind of a funny distillery, as many of these sort of new world distilleries are. It started in 2009 in the Melbourne area. It's the state of Victoria in Australia. That's kind of a dry, warm southern part of Australia, big wine country in there. That's where the Barossa Valley is and the Yarra make excellent wines in that part of the world. Got off to a slow start in 2009, small distillery trying to make their way until they got an investment in 2015 by an organization known as Distill Ventures out of the UK. Distill Ventures is a wholly owned subsidiary of a company you may have heard of called Diageo. The largest liquor entity on this planet owns a non-trivial. They own Johnny Walker and a non-trivial number of the Scottish distilleries, and they encouraged them to go in a particular direction. One of the thing, the fellow behind it, a guy named David Vital, was a beer maker first. And so he has stuck to his beer roots a little bit where they use both, you know, beer and distilling yeast and a darker malt. So it's quite a strong grain flavor, which is interesting to me, rather than just sticking with the very mild barley approach that most people do. And small still setup, 1,800 liter wash still, 600 liter spirit still. Because of how hot it is in the Melbourne area, they actually have additional cooling jackets and things to keep the distillation process under control so they don't overheat. And then they are, because they're in the wine region, they actually age in wine casks. So these are bought from Yolumba and Penfolds, Wolf Blass, those kinds of wineries, which are all in that area nearby. Often those are typically French and American oak casks that have already had wine in them for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. when the wine is drained, the barrels are, while still wet, are sold to the distillery, and the distillery then will put the whiskey into it for at least 2 years. That's the requirement for Australia to be called a whiskey, but they go a little longer, sometimes 3 or 4 years. And in this particular case, for this edition, they then finish it in a sherry cask, into your proper Spanish sherry casks. That's not that strange. You know, sherry is wine, just it's been fortified with brandy before it's barreled. Obviously, you don't spend a lot of time in barrels around here. But that's because it's too warm and too dry. You know, the aging process for whiskey is really about sort of the respiration of the barrel. The contents warms up and pushes into the wood and cools down and pulls out. And when you have humidities as low as you have in that part of the world, you actually lose water faster. You lose alcohol. So the alcohol rate tends to rise in this part of the world over time, as opposed to in Scotland, where the alcohol rate would fall. So they tend to barrel lower level, where up in Scotland, you'd come in at 65, 68, even 70%. They're coming in around 55 or so, but they still cut with water. These are all 48%, which is a respectable alcohol level for a whiskey. This particular edition is not directly bottled by Starward. You can't buy this from Starward. This actually comes from a group called the Whiskey Club. So you subscribe to the Whiskey Club, and they request custom bottlings from Starward, and you can then buy it through them. This one was $140 Australian dollars, about 90 US, I'm afraid, only in Australia. So it's been good fun to drink. There's not much left. I believe I got this yesterday. Maybe the day before. So I've been sharing it with friends. It is a little heady. It's quite fruity. The wine is definitely there. It is also quite a young whiskey. So, you know, it tastes and drinks very much like a New World whiskey. This is not your old Dalmore 18 by any stretch of imagination. And for $90, you know, it's fun, but pricey for what it is.
Is it like a bourbon-y kind of a thing?
It's a jammy fruit bomb of a whiskey.
Jammy.
That's what they say on the website. It must be true.
Yeah.
What's the Pedro Jimenez cask? Is that from Spain or Mexico?
So that's that's a Spanish sherry cask, right? Course. And that's, you know, and those are typically finishing casks. The Scots do this all the time, right? But, you know, when you have these low alcohol, you know, a sherry cask is 22% alcohol, then wine's even lower than that. Right. And so there's a kind of funkiness that can come from this. Like, you don't want to spend a lot of time in those barrels. And
honestly, I like to eliminate the middleman. I was going to say, straight, to be honest.
I like sherry. And I'd be more recognizing that sherry is just wine with brandy yet. It's like, just drink the brandy.
You're right. Good point. You could simplify things. We do Windows Weekly every Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. I want to wrap it up. We got to get to Twig here. Yes.
Can I just show you something real quick? I grabbed a drink and I realized this is a thing I see in Mexico. I've never seen in the United States, which I think is wonderful.
It's a seltzer bottle.
A seltzer bottle, but it has a built-in. You've seen this before. So to me,
you've seen them in the Three Stooges. Put it down your pants, right, Paul. Do the right thing.
Right. I know, but it's like literally a disposable water dispenser.
I used to have them delivered to my door in San Francisco. There was a company called the Seltzer Sisters. They found a bunch, because this is in the 20s. Boy. The seltzer guy would come to your door like the milkman and deliver those bottles.
Oh, that's
they'd take them back and they'd refill them. And so the Seltzer Sisters found a bunch of these old bottles and had a business briefly for doing it.
I love
it. It was wonderful.
We went through a period where we got milk delivered, you know, as adults, which was unusual. But yeah, I've never seen seltzer. Oh my God. This is might be the height of entitlement. Although
it's a shame it's plastic. I wish it were. Thick glass bottles with the metal spritzers.
Oh yeah. No, this is non-recyclable.
It's Mexico.
By the way, sherry is a protected name for booze. You can only Spanish sherry can be called sherry.
Oh, I know
they make sherry here in Australia, but they call it Apera.
Nice.
It's
they should call
short
it, you
for
know,
aperitif.
Yeah, just sell it. You know, sherry with an I.
Sherry.
Yeah, exactly.
Our show is every Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1900 UTC. You can watch us live at youtube.com/twit.
right when the show starts and it ends right when the show ends, although we're segueing into Twig, so guys, just keep the YouTube going as I wander over. If you want to watch the show at your own convenience, which is really how it's intended, you'll find copies at the website, twit.tv/ww. You could subscribe in your favorite podcast player. There's also a YouTube channel, which is great for sharing clips of moments that you really thought were quite interesting to your friends and family. Paul is at Thurrott.com, T-H-U-R-R-O-T-T.com. His books are at leanpub.com. Richard Campbell's at runasradio.com. They're gonna do a little scramble and go other places. Paul, you're still in Mexico next week.
Yep.
Richard, you're in God knows where next week.
I'll be in exactly. Where in the world is Richard Campbell?
He looks like Waldo, too. Yeah.
A game we could all play.
We'll do Brisbane next week.
Look for the flannel gentleman in the crowd of people in a different country.
So you're slowly, that's good. You're slowly heading west is what you're doing. You're working
I'm going to get back across the Pacific.
You're not backtracking. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Paul. Thank you all for watching. We'll see you next time on Windows Weekly.
Hey there, I'm Micah Sargent from Twit, and you may be asking a question. What in the world do you do if you want to thank that hard-working team of yours? Well, why not gift them a Club Twit corporate subscription? Oh, and here's a secret. You'll be benefiting yourself, too, because you will be able to keep your team informed and entertained with podcasts covering the latest in tech, so they'll always stay up to date. With a Club Twit subscription, they're going to get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. They'll get access to the members-only Discord server where they can chat with fellow Club Twit members and all of us here at Twit, and exclusive shows like Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit and look for corporate plans for complete details.